Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hello?
Hi.
We are going to begin the board meeting. We're in open session. As soon as our board members take their seats. Welcome, everyone. This is the St. Louis Coastal Unified School District's regularly scheduled January 15th meeting. We had closed session and considered two student discipline matters, which we will take action on shortly. And do we have consensus by the board members on the order of business? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, we'll maintain the agenda as posted. And I'll entertain a motion on action on student second. Any discussion or comments regarding the minutes? We only have one set, correct? No, we have two sets. This will be the minutes of December 11th, 2012. Okay, seeing none. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Now we'll consider the approval of minutes for January 8th, 2013.
I'll move approval of the minutes for January 8th, 2013.
Okay. Okay, we have a motion by Marilyn and second by Ellen for the minutes of January 8th, 2013. Any comments, corrections? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. And we have no student representatives tonight. I probably couldn't get their ski gear out of the closet in time to get over here. And I want to thank the administration for turning up the heat the one night that I wore extra layers of clothing. So. I do appreciate that. So let's see. We're going to have public comment. Anyone who would like to address the board on any matter that is not on the agenda. We prefer that you wait to address agenda items at the time of the item. However, should you have difficulty in waiting for that, you're welcome to address the board now. Okay. And then just for your own information, if you would like to submit a request to speak for later agenda items, we appreciate it. We'll make sure we give you a chance to speak, even if you haven't turned in a slip, though. Okay. We'll bring it back to the board and move on to official correspondence. We had a number of pieces of correspondence received, mostly regarding the Teach Bishop's Peak situation, and I believe we had one other correspondence regarding the gardens in the gardens at some of our school sites and maintaining those. And I know all board members had a chance to review the correspondence, and we appreciate the input. Okay, we'll go to the superintendent for state of the budget update. Or is that going to be Mr. Miller?
And for the board, I'd just like to give you, Rick's got a story to tell. I have 10 seconds to take, probably a little bit longer than that, actually. Today, School Services of California held a conference that was an analysis and interpretation of the state budget as presented by the governor last week. And after the governor had made his speech, a couple of board members called and said, what do we make of this? And my comment was optimistic that, you know, for the first time in years, the education community had received a positive note from the governor about funding and that we could probably look forward to some good news. I need to change my assessment as of today. One of the aspects of the governor's budget that is going to impact basic aid districts is the folding of categorical programs into the revenue limit for revenue limit schools. What that does is it takes away up to $7 million worth of funding from our district in terms of categorical programs. Right now, the state takes $4.5 million from us, as you know, for our fair share of pain. And my optimism was that somehow there was going to be a way for them to give us back some of our fair share of pain. But since our fair share of pain is manifested in the loss of categorical funding, and if they take categorical funding and make it part of a revenue limit, there's nothing left to give back to us. These thoughts, these conceptions of School Services California are very preliminary, and it needs to be stated that basic aid districts were not an individual item of the governor's budget. I don't believe, School Services doesn't believe, that any thought was given to the aspects of what happens to basic aid schools. But in the long run, if they're going to take categorical funding, and in the long run meaning over a 3 or 4 year period, because this plan of the governor's is to be phased in, I think it's 2020 is the final year of his phase, and it's a 4 or 5 year plan. But regardless, in the long run, if the categorical funding is lost, then we lose the only part of state funding that we get, and it's a lot of money. So one of the things we have to watch very carefully, and we have to be, if we can, proactive and active about, is guarding our interests and trusting to the lobbying efforts of School Services and other organizations that can craft some sort of language that would allow us to participate some form in our old categorical funding model. I guess that what I'm saying is today's most of it.
That's site improvement money.
Yeah, site improvement program. And we backfill it from our general fund in the belief that at some point we would get that money back and we could still continue to roll out the school site allocation from SIP.
So when you talk about us losing categorical funds, it means either we decide to backfill that program from the general fund or that program has to go away.
What we have done, and Eric has talked about this in the past, that the continuing removal of $4.5 million from our funding pool of money, you really don't know what that means until you're confronted with the damage that's caused. And we've had 4 years now of significant millions of dollars removed on an annual basis from our revenue stream, and it's starting to play havoc in our budget. That's one of the reasons we're going to be here today talking initially about some of the issues we're confronting with a shortfall in matching our revenues to our expenses, so that this $4.5 million, in my mind, we always had a chance. We always were going to get it back. But the new funding model that the governor rolls out doesn't play by the same rules as when they took it away. Right. So now we have to learn about what our new world looks like, and it doesn't look as hopeful as I thought last week when all of education was going to get an extra $2 billion. Let's be honest, basic aid districts are not in the pool of districts that suffered significantly from the state shortfall, and I don't think we can expect a whole lot of people thinking about our interests first.
I'm glad I didn't call you last week. I've just been more disappointed this week. Thank you. And
Chris,
go ahead.
Could I ask a question? So the way I've been reading it, it looks like there essentially is going to be an increase in districts' revenue limits. And that increase in district revenue limits will include the categoricals. Is that correct?
That's what.
Plus a premium for districts that have high numbers of lower socioeconomic students, foster kids, and EL students, right?
Correct.
Up to like 35% more.
Up to 50% in districts that have significant right. numbers of that category of child, and up to 35% for all others.
So with the recalibration of revenue limit, do you expect that they'll look at basic aid revenue limits, say your revenue limit plus whatever the additional monies you'd get, that's what you would have gotten from the state, and the rest is on you guys? Is that kind of what you're thinking is going
to
happen?
I was open to that kind of outcome, and what there was a logic applied to that,
right?
Okay, but at this point, there's no clear impact on basic aid districts, except that clearly the categorical programs are being rolled into the revenue limit.
Assuming that by May 15th the legislature approves
they
that.
Just go away, yeah. You know, they no longer exist. So the revenue limits of, let's just say revenue limit of a revenue limit district is going to be $6,600 per student.
Right.
And they're going, and that goes up from the current level of around $5,500 or $5,000 depending. And to that they're going to add 35% of your ADA count of students that are free and reduced, in poverty, underperforming, homeless, those kinds of things. They'll categorize them somehow. So you can get an additional 35% of the 6,600. Let's say it's 3,300 now.
But only per student.
Only per student, exactly.
Right.
So somehow that's going to come to pass for revenue limit districts. For basic aid districts, there's been nothing except for the feeling that if that's true, then what do we do about our categorical programs?
Right. Essentially, it almost seems like they're talking about codifying what we're already doing.
Yes.
And if at some point the amount of money that the state gives, including categoricals to us, were met, then we might, in the future, see some increases, which reminds me again that we're not a wealthy basic aid school district like
right.
there, as there are some very, very wealthy basic aid school districts.
Very true. We're very poor. We're very poor revenue limit district. If we were to
right.
be applied to our current revenue limit, it would be $5,300 per student, if I remember correctly. And in the county, only one other district
right.
is lower than that.
Yeah, I think we're what 10th out of 11 or 11th out of 12th or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was kind of a shift in a direction I hadn't anticipated.
We're not immune to that vocabulary. What I'm going to attempt to do, and I know it's going to take a little while, is take our budget scenario and try to explain it in as simple language as we can, because even with what Mr. Miller presented, we sometimes get really mixed up with our terminology when we're discussing our budget. So I'm going to be purposefully simplistic in this explanation. And my purpose tonight is really to do three things. To bring some specificity to our own situation. What's happening here in San Luis Coastal as far as our structural deficit in our budget. Secondly, what are some short-term resolutions? Are there any things we can do here at the mid-year point to deal with that deficit? And then thirdly, to give some suggestions on how we might navigate our next steps. I'm going to be talking in big round numbers in this presentation. So purposely, again, this is not super specific. So let's start talking about revenues. Let's start with revenues, the money we get. There are actually about 27 different sources of revenue in the school district, which I didn't know until I started looking into this. The largest is what we term our revenue limit. This is the secured and unsecured taxes that we receive locally. It makes up about $59 million of our budget. This is the money we keep from local property taxes. So the fact that we are a basic aid district or a community-funded district means that the money that we generate in our local economy stays with us, stays with our students. We do not receive money for the numbers of students we have. We don't receive money for our average daily attendance, as most districts do. We don't send our money up to Sacramento and then get a portion return. This is our revenue limit. This, in fact, is what makes us basic aid. We have more than we would earn if we counted on ADA. That $59 million represents the amount that we keep minus what we use for our charter. So our charter school, Bellevue Santa Fe, already has its money pulled off of that revenue limit. That's not included in that figure. We receive about $3 million in federal funds. Federal funds are from Washington, D.C., and they come in two primary categories. Special education. This is the money we get to do the Individuals with Disability and Education Act. It makes up about $1.4 million of that amount. To put that in perspective, we spend about eight times that amount on special education. So we are certainly not fully funded. The other 1.6 million approximately is for disadvantaged students and learning English learners, so mostly in the form of Title I and Title III dollars. Then we have state revenue. This is what Mr. Miller was referring to. State revenue used to have a lot of strings attached. There are fewer and fewer strings attached to what we do with state revenue. It makes up about $4 million. Three primary categories. We get categorical funds. That's money that at least at one time had strings attached into what it was to be spent for. We get lottery funds, lottery receipts. And we get mandated costs when they come. This is money we get reimbursed for things that we're required to do. Those don't come very often, but we do get mandated costs as part of this. It's important to know that we are entitled, as Mr. Miller said, to over $8 million of state categorical funds, but we only receive $4 million. This is that fair share of pain that we talk about. So in our district, we get more money right here in our revenue limit and less money up here with state categorical funds. Then we have local revenue. This is a pretty healthy amount, $5.5 million. This is money that we generate locally. This is rentals, leases. We have school properties that are closed that we generate income from. This is parent pay transportation. Contracts with other districts. We serve other small districts within our school district in various ways. ROP apportionment. We charge tuition for some foreign students. Our interest-bearing accounts, of course, would go into this category of local revenue. We should be proud of this amount of money, and this is always something that we're looking to generate more of. Oh, let me go back. There we go. Then we have a transfer. This is really, you know, it's kind of funny to, where do we put this? Is it really revenue? This is something that we're transferring from a fund that we also have. So is it really revenue generated? It's from Fund 20. And I'll explain Fund 20 a little bit later, but we'll put it in the revenue side because we're actually using it for a purpose that revenue generates. But I'll explain a little bit about what 20 rarely go over what we plan because Mr. Miller cuts off people as soon as something comes in that looks as if it's going to go over budget. The largest amount of budgeted expenditures in a school district like ours, like any school district, is salaries and benefits. So we spend $67 million on salaries and benefits. And this makes up health benefits, wages, the amount that the district contributes to pensions, unemployment insurance, disability insurance, workers' compensation insurance, stipends for coaches. That all goes into this pile. Oh, it's at the end. Okay. I'll go ahead and point out right now that sometimes people want to know how is that broken up, the amount we spend on salaries. And so you can see that about two-thirds is on certificated staff, teachers, and other certificated employees. About 8% on management and 27.5% on classified. That's probably a little low than the state averages in the management category, a little higher than state averages on the classified category. Now, one other thing I'd point out is that $67 million makes up about 84% of our total budgeted expenditures, which is actually about average. That's a good place to be. If you're spending in the mid-80% on people, we're a people organization, that's a pretty healthy place for a school district to be. Next on that chart, we have materials and supplies. So this is about $4 million that we spend on books, instructional materials, paper, audio visuals, lab materials, fertilizer for fields. It's stuff. This is our stuff part of the school district, the things that we spend on materials. Much of those funds are located at school sites. Then we have about $8 million in a bunch of categories. We'll group them in one and just call it operations or operating expenses. This is our utility expenses, fuel for our bus fleets and automobiles, contracts, professional development is out of this category, field trips, athletics, attorney fees, equipment repairs, some capital equipment out of operations, leases that we're involved in, so that's about $8 million. And then the last category, about $1 million of kind of a catch-all. This would be everything else. Interagency contracts that we have with other districts, any settlement we have to enter into, deductibles, mileage reimbursements, dues and memberships. It's kind of that other category. So if you look at where we are, we have a $7 million deficit, approximately $7 million deficit, between revenues and expenditures in the current year, right now. That's not a healthy place for a school district to be. Now, if you remember, we had about 84% of our expenditures spent on personnel. If you were to take that $67 million and move it over to the revenue side, it would become about 92% of our actual revenues are spent on personnel. That is an unsustainable place to be. We're spending $67 million out of the $73 million we're receiving on personnel expenses. Personnel expenses only rise unless you have significant retirements, furloughs, cuts in hours, layoffs, etc. Personnel expenses, as a former personnel director, they just go up. You have cost of living adjustments, you have step and column raises, health care is rising at double-digit rates. So the amount of money we're spending on personnel, if you look at it from the revenue side, is not at a good place. Now, if you remember, we cut $4.4 million from our budget last year. How did we end up when we had an $8 million deficit last year, cut $4.4 million, and are still faced with a $7 million deficit? Well, a lot of it has to do with personnel. I mean, those costs have continued to rise even after making those budget cuts last year. Now, if this was your family budget, one of the first things you might do is go to your savings account and say, okay, we have this problem. We're going to have to dip into savings, which is exactly what we do. So let's look at our savings in the school district. We have unrestricted reserves. These are reserves that have no strings attached to them. They have the strings that only the Board of Education wants to put on them. We have an $8 million reserve for economic uncertainty. This represents 10% to our tax base is Pacific Gas and Electric, is PG&E. And at any time, we could suffer a change in tax rate structures that PG&E pays. This board, many members of this board, know full well that in the year 2000, when there was a bankruptcy declared, the Board of Equalization changed that rate structure significantly for PG&E, and we instantly lost $10 million. We lost $10 million in a two-year period because of that. The other reason is because our revenue limit is based largely on local property taxes. We don't know what's going to happen with local property taxes. And in fact, in the last few years, we've seen a significant recession, drop in prices, reassessment of property tax values, foreclosures. Those numbers have been negative. This is the first year in a couple that we've seen an increase there. And the third reason we have such a large amount of economic uncertainty is because as a basic aid community-funded district, we're always subject to the whims of the legislature. The discussion you just had about how the governor and the legislature is going to deal with Proposition 30, which is an outstanding thing, a windfall for schools, may affect us even negatively. It might not have a positive impact on us. So we have a large amount of reserve for economic uncertainty. We also have $7 million above and beyond that, which is a wonderful thing. This happens because at the end of the year, if we have money unspent, it drops down into our reserve. So San Luis Coastal is in a wonderful place in that we have $15 million unrestricted that we can go to. Remember, however, what is our structural deficit this year? It's $7 million. That is where we're going this year. That's how we're paying our bills, is the fact that we have reserves to do that. We can't do that beyond this year. I mean, if everything was status quo, we'd use up all of that unrestricted reserve, drop to that level of economic uncertainty, which the board has said do not go beyond. So let's look at another set of things that sometimes are confused with being reserves. They're really not reserves because they have specific purposes, but they are money that we set aside. We have developer fees. About $8 million is in our developer fee account. This is money that is brought into the district from both commercial and non-commercial building and improvements. So when somebody does something to their house, they pay developer fees to the school district. We can only use developer fees for two purposes. One, to build a new school, if we need a new school, and the other is to deal with school issues only having to do with growth. If the district is growing at a pace that we need to add buildings, you cannot use developer fees for improvements. You can't use developer fees for putting new roofs on buildings. It's for the purpose of growth. So it's a very, very restricted funds, and school districts that have tried to kind of raid their developer fees for capital projects found themselves in big trouble. It's only used for growth or new school buildings. Secondly, we have a group of funds that are for food services. This is sometimes called our cafeteria fund. I think it's called the cafeteria fund at the state level, appropriately so. Food services is a self-sustaining organization. They receive money from the federal government for free and reduced lunches and spend that money. They have mandates about health. The board gets involved in food services, of course, in making decisions about bids and products and food quality and what we serve. But food services as a department has to be self-sustaining. We can't take their money, and they can't contribute their money to the general fund. And the last is this sizable chunk of money in Fund 20, $9.5 million, minus this year $1.5 million, because we pulled $1.5 million from this fund and threw it into reserves. So what is Fund 20? Fund 20 has been built up over the last 6 years, and it is intended to take care of future unfunded mandates. It is the law. The law was called GASB 45, General Accounting Standards Board Statement Number 45, which said that public entities like school districts have to take care of anything that they have in their contracts that are a future promise. In our case, all of our employees, management, classified, certificated, if they've served 10 years in our school district and then leave the school district between the ages of 53 for classified employees, 55 for certificated and management employees, they have health benefits until the age of 65, paid at the same rate as if they were district employees. So the employee is still paying a portion of that health benefit, but the district has to absorb about 75 or 80% of future health benefits for our employees that have been with us a while. Last year we had an early retirement incentive, a garage sale, bring in a roommate, figure out some way to raise some extra revenue, work at nights. You might do some things with the expenditure side, curb your electricity usage, don't go on that family vacation, whatever the case may be. So as a school district, we spent a good portion of our winter break, a group of the people in the executive council kind of scouring our budget. Are there things where right now, middle of the stream, we can find some money? Meaning, are there some revenues that we can expect that we didn't really anticipate? And more importantly, have we over-budgeted in any areas? Are there areas where maybe we can alter our plans, or in fact, we've budgeted an amount of money that we might not spend? So that's what we did. We scoured our budget. So what are some examples of what we were able to come up with? And this is still a work in progress because we haven't finished this work yet. But we believe we can come up with, and people in the Instructional Services Department are still sweating, but we believe we can come up with about $2 million. And let me just give you some examples. The board at their last meeting increased our rental income. You actually had an item that increased the amount of money we're charging both nonprofits and profit organizations to use our facilities. That'll bring in another $25,000 between now and June 30th, we're estimating. It's not a huge amount, but it does alter our budget. The board didn't end up having to have an election this year. Believe it or not, we have to every other year schedule a chunk of money to do an election because we have to pay for that. They're not free. We have to give money to the county commissioner to do an election. So about $85,000 is what we would pay to run an election for three council members, three board members. Well, our three board members actually ran unopposed, which means there didn't have to be a ballot. So that's money that's we found. I mean, we don't have to put that in our budget. We also believe by looking at the Departments of Information Services, Buildings and Grounds, Instructional Services, and Student Support Services, we can pull back some unencumbered funds. And what I mean by unencumbered funds is money that is not already encumbered for salaries and benefits through the year, and money that is not being already given to contracted services or promised for supplies or what have you. It doesn't mean we have unplanned for expenses. So this will cause a little bit of altering in our course in some areas. But in others, we found that if we look at our budget over the last 2 years, there are actually some categories where year after year, we seem to have some money drop to the bottom. It's still our money. It's still going into our reserves or back into Fund 20. But if we tighten our budget up a little bit, then at least this discrepancy in the current year of revenues and expenditures might get a little lessened. It's kind of semantic in that we'd still have that money. It would still drop to the bottom line. But the more realistic we can be about our budget, we think it's the better for all concerned. It creates maybe not a $7 million problem currently, but a $5 million problem. So I'm going to do some math here for you in prognosticating about next year. So try to follow me here. I'm trying to keep this simple. But let's just assume for a moment that we take what's happened this year and we carry it forward another year. $80 million worth of expenditures, $73 million worth of revenue. But what if we were to have this year's budget cuts be our starting point for next year? In other words, if I paid myself $20 a month to go buy Starbucks coffee as my allowance, and I decide this year I'm only going to spend $15. I'm not going to spend the whole 20. I'm trying to cut back. Next year, I'm not going to re-up my budget back to 20. I'm going to start with that 15. That's my new normal. So if we take that $2 million and have that become next year's budget start, we've made a significant cut for next year. But the board, we're hoping, will continue with our initiatives, and we believe we're going to need to start another preschool program in Los Osos. That's an expenditure that we'll need to add to this conundrum. Step and column increases are about $1 million. So to pay all of our employees without any raise at all, just step and column, to stay with us another year, we're going to have to come up with another $1 million on the expense side. Good news is that this year we had a one-time retroactive raise for our teachers that is finished. So we can actually pull that out of that step and column increase for next year, which kind of makes that a wash. But let's look at the revenue side. We have some issues there. We have to be realistic. We have to subtract that $1.5 million that we transferred from Fund 20. It really isn't revenue in the sense that we're getting it from somebody. We're transferring it from ourselves. We think, which is also the increase employees will have to pay on their share. So it's pretty significant. So if you look at that math, and I did it quickly but hopefully clearly, even after this year, even after cutting and making that our new normal, we're going to end up with an estimated $6 million deficit next year. It's those expenses that we have to contend with at the same time our revenues change. So not a pretty picture. Now, some people might ask, where does Prop 30 fall in this? And I think there's a good discussion about that because last Thursday, when the governor released his budget, we thought, all right, looks like maybe they'll change that amount of state categorical funds. Today, not so sure. So between now and ostensibly, if the legislature passes a budget based on the governor's May revise, we will get an idea of what that means for us. Do I have to? Okay, there we go. But we really don't know what the effect of Prop 30 is going to be. I think, I might be wrong on this, Mr. Miller, but it's probably not bad news in terms of that $6 billion. But it might not be good news. It might not be that that's reduced to $5 million or $4 million or $3 million as we kind of thought it might be. But we'll see. We'll just have to see. So what are we going to do about $6 million next year? Well, again, in executive cabinet, we did some brainstorming. And this is just brainstorming. Sorry about that. I think it's important to recognize that when we have so many budgets, so many accounts, it's kind of dangerous to just throw it all up on a wall, get a bunch of people and say, start going at it. So what we did is we looked at areas where we believe that we can realize some efficiencies or do things differently. This is preliminary thinking because obviously the superintendent's going to make a recommendation and the board then is going to weigh in on that recommendation. These are significant areas in our school district. These are the areas that I'm going to show you are things that in some ways are hallmarks of our school district that we're looking at targeting as potentially making some cuts. But I think more importantly, figuring out if there are some things that we can do in these areas that other school districts have done that have faced these same kind of dilemmas and not realize major changes in our programs. We spend $2.4 million annually on counseling services in our school district. We have elementary counselors full-time at most of our elementary sites. We have a 275-to-1 ratio at our middle school and high school sites. We're not suggesting taking $2.4 million away from counseling, but this is certainly an area where we can look at what other districts have done in this area and see if there's some efficiencies. If we make cuts to counseling services, let's make no mistake, that would involve layoffs. That will involve job loss. We spend about $300,000 a year on reading recovery. This is one-to-one instruction. It's something we've done in this district a long time. It's something we've done well. It's a proven intervention for first grade students. But it is one-on-one instruction. It is an expensive intervention. So that's another area for us to look at. It's difficult to say this in light of what happened last week or 2 weeks ago in Connecticut, but high school campus supervision. We employ noon supervisors, classified employees at lunchtime, just like our elementary and middle schools do. We also employ a full-time campus security officer at each of our high schools that's a district employee. And we have contracts, full-time contracts, with San Luis Obispo Police Department and Morro Bay Police Department to have an armed officer available to us full-time at each of our high schools. It's an area for us to look at. Do we need that level of service at our high schools? We spend $1.3 million a year on our instructional media center and library services. We have full-time library techs, and actually more than full-time at many of our sites. We have 1.2 or 1.3 FTE at many of our elementary sites. Of classified positions at the elementary level, we have full-time credentialed school librarians and library assistants at the secondary levels. Are there different ways of running our library services? We've scheduled annually for the next several years about $800,000 to go into Wi-Fi installations. Over the winter break, we finished making both Laguna Middle School and Los Osos Middle School completely Wi-Fi ready. Should we look at cutting back on that expense in this area? We spend $200,000 out of our general fund. Some of the school sites spend more than that on summer school. Summer school is optional. It's a great intervention. It's done some great things for our students, but it is one area that we might look at. We spend $900,000 on a very ambitious professional development. This is not just district professional development, but many of the school sites have their own professional development accounts and expenditures here. Again, an area that doesn't necessarily affect somebody's job, but where we might be able to make some cuts. Special education takes $11.5 million out of our budget. We are by law required to offer FAPE, free and appropriate public education, to all students regardless of disabilities. But it's a hefty sum that we pay to do special education. Are there efficiencies? Are there different ways of doing the program that we can think about? At this point, we're anticipating 8 to 10 certificated retirees. We'll have a handful of classified retirees also. Are there ways that we cannot replace people who are leaving us? It's difficult to do. It's tricky, especially in teaching positions, because we're not necessarily interested in raising class sizes, which this does. But at least are there some ways that we can look at the retirees that we're having and do some replacements with far less expensive employees. There should be some savings in this area. We spend about $1 million on our English Learners program. We made some significant cuts last year to this program, changed our model. Are there efficiencies that we can realize there? And we spend about $2.2 million on transportation. This includes home-to-school transportation, athletic transportation, field trip transportation. We only receive about $600,000 from the state to do home-to-school transportation, and then it's pulled back. That's one of the fair shares, so we really don't receive anything to do home-to-school transportation. Transportation is not required unless it's part of a student's IEP in the area of special education. Are there efficiencies there?
Right, Rick, does the transportation we're talking about include the special education transportation,
yes,
or is that included in the special education?
No, it's separate from the special education budget.
Thank you.
So the question is, can we find $6 million in those areas? Maybe, maybe not, but those are areas that we're targeting to look at. And I think it's significant when we do this kind of exercise to think about what we might not be looking at. And so there are some areas that we purposely have kind of left off there. And that doesn't mean that that's permanently left off. As we go through this process of meeting with stakeholder groups, parents, principals, teachers, PTA, interest groups, as Mr. Miller forms his budget project team, we may eliminate some of those areas for consideration and add others. But there's some things that we believe we need to continue as a priority because we've already made cuts to those programs or because of just where we are in the district. We made a cut to our music program, especially at the primary level, last year. So we're not looking at that at this time. We started family resource centers at both the Coast in Los Osos and a grand opening for another one this week in San Luis Obispo. These are virtually no-cost positions. We're probably spending less than $20,000 on these two family resource centers, but we believe they are really the future to connecting a lot of our families, especially families in need, to the services in our community. We're not looking necessarily at this time at elementary PE. It provides prep time for our teachers, and also we know that having credentialed, trained teachers doing physical education is good for our kids. We're not targeting preschool. It seems like the best intervention for the learning gap at the earliest levels, offering preschool to our students who are not accessing it. We need to steam forward with science, technology, engineering, arts, and math and make that a larger part of our curriculum. And so we don't want to take away from those initiatives. Speaking of initiatives, we have a strategic plan, and we believe it's really important that we keep our mission focused and make our cuts farthest away from those things that we've committed to as a board and as an organization. I put TOSA and instructional coaching on that list of things to look at. We do believe, and I know our superintendent believes strongly in the instructional coaching as one of the best professional development models. So we may be able to look at some efficiencies there, but it seems like a powerful tool for professional development. We're not suggesting cuts to our nurse and health service program at this time. And I think this is important. We're not suggesting looking at classroom teachers or class size as a way of solving that budget deficit. That's typically the easiest way to solve a budget deficit. raise class sizes, lay off a bunch of teachers, you've kind of solved it. But we have seen our primary classes go up from a 20-to-1 cap. We don't know what the budget is really going to be. It's a changing landscape between now and the May revise. We may need to modify our recommendations. What's really important is that anything involves a certificated layoff. We have very strict timelines, and in fact, those timelines are right on us. If we were to do any type of layoff, and some of those areas lend themselves to potential layoffs, EL programs, librarians, counseling services, those are certificated positions. We would have to do a layoff notification at the February 19th meeting, likely, in order to make sure that those employees are noticed by March 15th by law. So it's a serious issue. And obviously, the board's going to adopt their budget. Even if they adopt it after a layoff, you'll be adopting your budget in the spring, making revisions to it up until July, when we actually know what our real numbers are. So humor me with a second first with a story here. You're probably wondering what that is. My father, Floyd Robinette, had the privilege of working on the NASA projects in the 60s and 70s, and he was an aerospace engineer, and he worked on the fuel systems design for the lunar excursion module, the vehicle that actually landed on the moon. And excuse me. Now, I remember when I was 10, he was called to an emergency in Houston. He'd never been to Houston, never been to Mission Control, but he was called out there in April of 1970 because a catastrophe had happened. One of the oxygen tanks in the service module had exploded on the seventh manned mission, Apollo 13, and had caused them to abort the mission. And as it turns out, the astronauts had to move from their command module into the little lunar excursion module in order to survive. They used it as more or less a lifeboat. The lunar module was made for two people to survive for a day and a half in that environment, not for three astronauts to survive for 4 days. But thankfully, they had the supplies they needed. There's plenty of food, plenty of water, plenty of oxygen, probably the most important component. And what they didn't have was a way to get rid of the carbon dioxide that was going to build up in that chamber. And so what they had to do is use a lithium hydroxide system, which was designed for it, to pull the poisonous carbon dioxide out. And my father was called there because he was one of the guys that designed that system. But the LEM module and the command module had different types of canisters for doing this very purpose. And so if you saw the movie Apollo 13, I'm probably making something that you're probably familiar with, you might think of my dad as being one of those nerdy guys with the black rimmed glasses and the slide ruler sitting in a room saying, here's what they have in space, figure this out. And so they ended up designing a tube using a piece of the spacesuit. They weren't going to have to use the spacesuit to walk on the moon, so they used that tube to basically get a square canister into a cylindrical type of fitting. They called it the mousetrap. So I share this not to try to draw some great analogy between this catastrophe. I mean, this was Gene Kranz, when he received the Congressional Medal of Honor, called this very thing NASA's finest moment. So I'm not trying to draw that analogy that we're in this huge catastrophe. So trust me. Because we're not in a catastrophe. We do not have to abort our mission. And in fact, our mission should stay in front of us. But I do think we're going to have to be a little ingenious and think about some of the things we're doing a little differently. If somebody can get, astronauts 240,000 miles safely back to Earth, we can certainly deal with a $6 billion budget problem. So I've spoken enough. I've tried to keep things simply at this point. Just know that we're committed to doing what the board wants and available for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Robinette? Any public comment on this issue? Okay. Seeing none, bring it back to the board. Chris?
I just want to thank you, Rick, for really explaining this in a way that is transparent and understandable, because so many times when people look at our budgets, it's like getting a phone book that's in Greek. So thank you.
Dr. Prater.
Ms. Millar, thank you, Rick. I want to thank Rick for being our storyteller, and he's worked hard on that. And I also want to let everyone know that his calendar is fairly well packed over the next 4 to 6 weeks, in that he's going to every school site in our district, and he's giving that presentation to our employees. And then I will, once this process...
...what the future of their job is. And you can imagine how corrosive and hard that is for people with families to endure. So I appreciate the presentation, and I would just say FTE is full-time equivalent. And there was one other one, but I can't think of it. So sometimes we lapse into school speech. So, and Marilyn, did you have a comment?
I did. I just wanted to thank Mr. Robinette, as everyone has. That was an excellent presentation. And I would call that budget for dummies. It's just totally understandable. And as I just said, I'd like to have a copy of it, of the PowerPoint, for myself. The one thing that I would ask you to elaborate on a little bit, if you could, is our reserve for economic uncertainty. I was on the board when we voted to raise that to the 10% level. And while it sounds like a high reserve, at some point in time we did sort of check around with other basic aid districts to see what they were holding in reserves. And at that time, I think Palo Alto was holding 100% of their budget. Could you speak to that at all?
Yeah, Schools for Sound Finance, which is kind of our information, you know, lobbying arm in Sacramento, actually recommends us having a higher reserve for economic uncertainty than that. The idea is that you need to have your economic uncertainty reserve be at such a level that if your basic aid status went away tomorrow, that you had a soft landing for that year. That difference between what you're getting in your revenue limit and what you would get for ADA, which in our district would be significant, $5,300 per ADA, that you have enough money there that you would not have to just lay off massive numbers of employees. You would have a year to make some plans. You know, the analogy is kind of that soft landing, that you'd be able to just sort of make some cuts, do your layoffs, get through the year by spending down that reserve. So I don't know what our reserve would need to be, Mr. Miller. You might know, to have that covered, but a 10% reserve probably doesn't quite do it.
Our economic uncertainty of the 10%, part of the discussions were what does 10% mean? And what does Palo Alto, Burlingame, some of the other basic aid districts do? And clearly 10% was a significant increase over 3, but $8 million represents just a portion of the amount of money we could lose by legislative action. And our difference between a revenue limit of $5,500 per student, or whatever it ends up being perhaps, and our property tax income is $21 million. So if, and don't forget about the days when Gray Davis was in his final moments as governor, and he mounted an attack on basic aid districts and actually introduced some legislation to eliminate our existence as basic aid districts. It's not been, it's been attempted before. We were successful in arguing that away, but ultimately you have to look at this as a – I don't want to – really, never mind. I'm not going to use fiscal cliff, but it is a possibility to fall off of a cliff through legislative action in terms of our revenues. And what our economic uncertainty is designed to do is to give us a glide path to a lower revenue and not have a catastrophic economic event dictating what our cuts are going to be and allowing us to at least have a thoughtful process of how to bring ourselves in for a graceful landing, as it were.
Thank you.
Just to be clear, in my own mind, as we were talking about our home savings accounts and making analogies like that, if I had money in my home savings account, I accrue that over a long period of time, or how I do it, because I don't have a lot of money to put in there at one chunk. So if we, again, used our reserves and took a huge amount, that's amount of money out of our reserves to solve a problem. That money would be gone for a long time. We would have to save it back up over time. We couldn't, then if we spent $4 million of that this year, we wouldn't magically have $4 million more next year.
We wouldn't. And in the past, when property tax values were going up 4% and 6% per year, we were able to put money into Fund 20 and build a reserve. In a year in which, or in a series of years, in which the state has taken $4.5 million from us consistently, our property taxes have been declining, we have been using our savings account in order to continue with our programs and the policies that we have. But ultimately, the uses of that money, we have to recognize the fact that it has a short life to it, especially as you're pulling six or four.
Good evening, school board. Thank you. We'll do that again. Good evening, school board. We are here tonight to present a mid-year update on student achievement in San Luis Coastal Unified School District. We will share some comparison assessment data for both elementary and secondary, as well as highlights of this year's intensive work with our teachers through their participation in district professional development and site-based coaching. We're really at that place where we can see the beginnings of a dramatic shift in instruction that we believe will jumpstart accelerated learning for all of our students.
As we continue to move forward in our district efforts, it is important to maintain a vision of the educational goals we have for our students. What are the ingredients necessary to prepare college and career-ready students? Well, all students need content area knowledge, as indicated by the center arc of the rainbow. However, this alone is not enough to prepare our students for the 21st century global economy. Within the context of core knowledge instruction, students must also learn the essential skills for success in today's world. The three areas framing content area knowledge include, first, life and career skills. Students need to pay rigorous attention to developing strong skills such as flexibility, initiative, self-direction, ability to work effectively in diverse teams, leadership, and responsibility. Secondly, learning and innovation skills. A focus on creativity, critical thinking, communication, and collaboration is essential to prepare our students for the future. Thirdly, information, media, and technology skills. Our children are growing up in an environment marked by an access to an abundance of information, rapid changes in technology tools, and the necessity to collaborate and make individual contributions on an unprecedented scale. To be effective in the 21st century, citizens and workers must be able to exhibit a range of functional and critical thinking skills related to this third area.
The rainbow describes a vision of success for our students. The arcs below the rainbow are the critical systems necessary to ensure student mastery of 21st century skills. They include standards and assessment. The Common Core State Standards and Smarter Balance Assessment System will fully be implemented in 2014-15. This set of national standards and assessments emphasize deep understanding, engagement of students in solving meaningful problems, and a balance of technology-enhanced, formative, and summative assessments. In San Luis Coastal, we have developed and adopted assessments that are Common Core aligned and assess students' critical thinking and reasoning. Curriculum and instruction focuses on providing opportunities for applying 21st century skills across content areas and enables innovative learning methods that integrate the use of inquiry, problem-solved approaches, and an integration of community resources beyond school walls. Our incoming STEAM program at Los Osos Middle School is just one example of innovative learning models we will be implementing for our students. Professional development helps teachers develop their abilities to use various strategies to reach diverse students and create environments that support differentiated teaching and learning. It also balances direct instruction with project-oriented teaching methods. This year, we have layered professional development to include both district and site-based coaching with a focus on research-based, cutting-edge instruction in mathematics, writing, and ELD. And finally, learning environments ensure the equitable access to quality learning tools for all students, professional learning communities to enable educators to collaborate and share best practices, and physical environments that will support the teaching and learning of 21st century skill outcomes.
With the vision of what we want to accomplish, we turn our attention to how will we accomplish our goals. By this time, you are familiar with the symbol representing our collaborative continuous improvement process. Our presentation tonight will address all sections of our process. We will share our mid-year data and analysis, and through video, you will get a glimpse of our planning and implementation
in San Luis Coastal Unified.
As we roll down this unfamiliar road, and although this wave is stringing us along, just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna...
We are going to start collecting seed ideas for information. Start thinking in your head right now. What are some of the things you might choose?
What's something you learned this year? Only a
fraction.
Oh, fractions. We know all about fractions, huh?
Something specific.
Wow.
So you were going to work on your journal. Teach someone how to write a story. You kind of did that with our first grade buddies, huh? Mm-hmm. So that might be a great topic.
Comprehension, communication with strategic scaffolding to guide appropriate linguistic choices.
Walking, you're 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 walking kind of like slower.
That's the only one that makes sense.
Yeah. See if you guys can come.
We'll check later.
Then lay out how many 2x4s I need.
Last week, you received a packet containing a variety of assessment results from both elementary and secondary ELA and math. Tonight, we are going to review specific comparison data. In looking at data trends, we typically use 3 to 5 years of data to measure growth. Since we are only in our second and in some areas our first year of implementing Common Core aligned district assessments, 3 to 5 year trends are not yet established, and therefore we're not yet able to determine a significant change in student achievement. As we transition to the Common Core, our common assessments have been designed for the following purposes: to introduce and implement the California Common Core state standards, to measure student progress on selected priority standards, to guide classroom instruction, and to guide professional development. Our current common assessments are by no means comprehensive. As we learn more about the Common Core expectations and assessments, our district assessment system will evolve to establish rigorous expectations for all students and lead collaborative discussions in using data to challenge our assumptions about teaching, learning, and leadership. Our common assessment in reading for students in kindergarten, first, and second grade is the BA3, and LLI will serve approximately 350 students this year, representing about 30% of our first and second grade students. An additional 60 kindergarten students are slated to be served in LLI this spring. With this comprehensive research-based intervention system in place, together with guided reading instruction in every K-2 classroom, we anticipate less students in the upper grades in need of reading intervention. Research reminds us that early intervention is the most effective way to ensure literacy for all students. The Scholastic Reading Inventory is a common assessment for students in grades 3 through 6. As a universal screener, it identifies students on track to meet year-end proficiency in reading. In the fall, 76% of our students were making adequate or higher progress towards year-end proficiency, the same percentage of students demonstrating year-end proficiency in the fall of last year. While the comprehensive literacy model implemented during the past several years addresses the need for acceleration and remediation in reading, we know that some students will still need additional intensive intervention to meet grade level proficiency. Leveled literacy intervention has been extended this year to address the needs of our at-risk students in grades 3 through 6. As indicated in that previous slide, 33% of our young readers are in need of intervention. This percentage drops 9 percentage points for upper grade students requiring intervention. Our goal is to ensure all students are proficient or advanced in reading by the time they leave elementary school. Although we have administered a common assessment in writing this fall to support our implementation of Writer's Workshop, we're not able to share the results from this assessment tonight. All of our K-6 teachers will be meeting this Friday in a professional development workshop designed to increase their understanding of the California Common Core state standards in writing and to level our student work on a narrative writing continuum. And we look forward to sharing these results with you in the future.
Secondary students in grades 7 through 12 English language arts courses participated in two types of assessment, multiple choice and an expository writing paragraph. The three green performance bands on the top, approximates standard, accomplishes standard, and exceeds standard, indicate students who are considered proficient. The data for our first 2 years of this assessment show that 58% of our students scored proficient on the multiple choice section as compared to 57% last year. 64% of students scored proficient in a writing task as compared to 50% last year. We attribute at least some of this increase in proficiency on the writing task to the collaborative work of our teachers during our scoring days last year. During these scoring days last year and again this year, teachers spent time collaborating around student writing using the Common Core aligned rubrics that we developed.
Our common assessments in math this year in elementary were designed to complement the professional development in mathematics for all pre-K through sixth grade teachers and principals. The assessments in elementary focused on Common Core state standards in number and operations in base 10 with transitional kindergarten, and first grade students participating in a one-on-one performance task interview to assess beginning number sense skills. Second through sixth grade assessments focused on fractions within the number and operations in base 10, with a performance task as the key component of the assessment, requiring students to demonstrate problem-solving skills and to communicate their thinking. As a pretest given to students before professional development in most cases, and in most cases before instruction occurred, these assessments modeled the formative assessment process in which pretest results are used to guide instruction and differentiation. Let's take a look at the results from the fraction multiple choice and performance task pre-assessment for second through sixth grade students. About half of our elementary teachers participated in a professional development day to collaboratively score performance tasks and analyze the multiple choice results. It was no surprise that 53% and 57% of the students demonstrated a limited or emerging ability to complete the multiple choice and performance tasks on a pretest of current grade level standards. A post-test will be administered in the spring following the mathematics professional development, instructional coaching, and classroom instruction in fractions to determine the progress students have made this year.
The performance tasks were designed to address students' application of mathematical thinking to real-world issues and challenges, their construction of sound mathematical arguments, and precision in their mathematical communication. Last year, we saw only 13% of students were able to meet or exceed standards in making sense of these problems and persevere in solving them. This year, 34% of students were proficient. We attribute this increase in proficiency on the performance task to our professional development efforts. Secondary mathematics teachers were engaged in scoring and professional development to begin our transition to the Common Core and to develop instructional practices necessary to support our students during this shift. Additional professional development has been offered to secondary teachers in the areas of performance tasks, student engagement, effective questioning techniques, and the use of technology in the mathematics classroom. Using the math assessment project lessons and performance tasks, teachers have continued to engage their students in complex problem solving using the Common Core standards for mathematical practice. Secondary teachers will also be offered additional professional development on the use of visual modeling in math later this month. Students in second through eighth grade were given a math attitude survey consisting of 14 questions in which they rated each statement strongly agree, there at the top, agree, unsure, disagree, or strongly disagree. Here are the results that we saw last year for grades 2 through 6, and then this year for grades 2 through 6, compared to the middle school students in grades 7 and 8 last year. And this year. This year, we saw a slight increase in the response for there are many ways to solve a math problem in both elementary and secondary. We also saw a similar increase in the response to the statement, I know many ways to solve a math problem. Furthermore, this year, students again overwhelmingly responded strongly agree to the statement, I want to do well in math. Our analysis of the survey suggests that our professional development may be having a positive effect on the way students think about solving math problems. Moving forward, we know that our math professional development in the areas of mathematical content and pedagogy, including student engagement, will be critical in creating 21st century students who are confident, cooperative learners, and self-regulated problem solvers.
Another of our goals has been to implement a system of tiered interventions to support students who need additional time and targeted research-based instruction to accelerate their learning. However, we have also discovered the value some of our intervention programs, such as Achieve 3000 and Fraction Nation, provide when used to enrich learning for our proficient and advanced students. This next video highlights a few of our time-tested successful interventions, as well as some newer interventions we began piloting last spring and during summer school.
There's been a couple times where he doesn't like how it sounds, so he says it again.
He's using really good phrasing.
Yeah,
that phrasing shows that he is really carrying the meaning.
One of the things that Mary read about was that they should be doing is, you know, that quick problem solving on the run kind of thing. And I feel like he was really doing that. You know?
Took the dog home.
Yeah. And if you look at took, does it look like look a little bit?
Yeah.
What's the difference between look and took?
This one's got a T and look has an L. We eat the little seeds inside the shell.
There was a file. Everyone ran to see it.
What's the second goal?
Read with expression.
We've been talking about that a lot.
And you read the word here, nectar, and then here you have no problem with it.
Bugs.
Right, good. Here's David, you need to say wasp and keep going. You made sure to say that ending sound. I'm proud of you. And I heard you read this page really nicely, too. He says meat, but he's really talking about bugs. So we're going to use this story as a context for thinking through some of these models. You could think of it as 100 rows of 1. And remember that like the 100, we can also think of it in a different way.
25 times 4.
25 times 4.
So it would be 25 and every
25. And each time we write these, it's just confirming something that we've already learned, that if you have these factors and you switch...
In order to ensure our students are prepared for the 21st century college and career expectations, we are committed to stay focused on the following: full implementation of the California Common Core State Standards, a comprehensive assessment system to monitor student progress and inform instruction, innovative, research-based instructional practices and interventions, and we know a collaborative effort is the key to our success. Teachers must work together in partnerships both at school sites and across the district if we are going to raise the bar for accelerated learning with all of our San Luis Coastal students.
As you can see, what's before you as a board are some pretty big and important decisions. The second student achievement report reveals that we are far from our destination. We're truly on our journey. My job, as I believe it to be, is to maintain our focus on our priorities. Maintaining the focus in San Luis Coastal, I thought Christopher Reeve, the former Superman, said it well. So many of our dreams seem impossible, then improbable, then inevitable. And what I want to urge the board to reflect on is where we are in this. And we still have people, staff, perhaps community members, perhaps administrators in our district that are in the improbable stage. They don't believe we're going to achieve those objectives that we set out in our strategic plan initiatives. And I happen to not be one of those. I actually am convinced we're going to make it. We must stay focused. And how we're going to do that? I believe these are the ways we will achieve the end game. The first one is an obvious one to anyone who's been in education and knows the classroom. Great teaching matters. In many ways, great teaching is what makes the difference. It turns the tide. How do we do that? Well, I believe leadership matters because it's great principles that lead a culture of achievement and a belief that all kids can make it. So we've adopted a new teacher evaluation tool. Our principals are hard at work investing in their own development to make sure they give every teacher in our school district great feedback on high-quality instruction. The instructional coaches are proving to be, in many cases, that very special place where teachers can go without the threat of evaluation. They get good feedback. They get a camaraderie of sorts, a collegiality of sorts, and fantastic feedback on what they can do to improve their practice. And then all the work that Amy Shields and Rita Delkiskamp and her team and their team are doing with professional development. We can't get there in an environment of Common Core state standards. We will not be able to achieve it without rigorous professional development that's ongoing, because the landscape of the classroom of the future will change because of those new standards, because it's a thinking curriculum. It isn't a regurgitation of knowledge curriculum. This will require that we change our practice. That's why number one is the number one thing we must keep our eye on. The second piece is something that I feel deeply about, whether you're in the 17th century, 18th century, or 21st century. The universal, I think, important skill is the ability to read well, the ability to write well, and the ability to express yourself well. If you can do those things right there, number two, you have a jump start in life. You will have a head start when you get to that interview, when you engage in relationships on teams. That is a critical life skill that I believe it's our responsibility to develop in our students. The third component is something we've talked about quite at length, and that's innovative practices. It's that innovative model that I'm looking for. We made a huge movement towards creating that at the middle level out at Loams. And the STEAM model, I believe, because I constantly do research, and I do believe that the future of the American worker is going to hinge on the ability to develop. Educating all of our students to high levels is a moral imperative. We can't leave one of our kiddos behind. We have to make it our mission in life to educate all of our kids to high levels. And because in America, quickly, we're realizing in the job market of the future that our greatest asset is our human capital. We need to start that conversation, keep it going, and know that we're doing everything in our power to educate all of our students within our control and our power to do that job with exceptional aptitude. And I just believe we need to stay the course. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Prater, and thank you, Rita, and your team for the presentation. I appreciate it. We're going to have a quick update by Dr. Pruitt, for the Loams program, and then we will move on to the Bishop's Peak Teach capacity and program issue. I appreciate everybody's patience. These were important matters, as you can tell.
Yes, good evening, President Millar, the members of the board, our superintendent, Mr. Dr. Prater, teach parents, welcome. My plan tonight is to give you a 5-minute exposure to a document, a planning document that we have begun In the short time since your approval of this exciting opportunity for us at Los Osos Middle School, we have started the process of planning, and of any day that I wish I was not legally blind, it would be today. But I am. But it's okay. I know this stuff, which is great. Thank you very much, Ms. Holmes. I wanted to just quickly expose you to the document, the things that we are focusing on, and also I've highlighted some elements, although we've done an immense amount of work up until this point. Each and every day is something new, is changing. It's extremely exciting. It's an opportunity for our incoming sixth graders on the coast, and I'm excited about that. But I did highlight some elements that I wanted you as the board to know about that are coming very soon, starting with the team staff selection. Ms. Holmes, if you could scroll to the right. I did want to make sure that you're aware that on the 18th, which is this Friday, our positions will close. Those are internal flown positions for sixth grade positions for this program. On 1/24, January 24th, we will do and conduct all-day interviews at Los Osos Middle School. Once we identify potential candidates in a rank order, myself, my assistant principal, possibly some people from the district office, will do some candidate classroom visits on the 28th and 29th. We'd like to go see those teachers in action and see them interact with their kids, and then we will come to some final decisions. I'm going to have you scroll back to the left again. I'm sorry, Kim. In curriculum, had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Kirk Martinez to discuss special education staffing and needs. We've also started a very important conversation with our staff at Loams. We have decided to develop our own ESLers at the middle school level, although that's not required at the high school level. ESLers are expected school-wide learning results, and they have those developed through WASC at both San Luis Obispo High School and Morro Bay High School. But we feel it's important as we create this program 6-8 that we are all able to identify what do we want one of our eighth graders to be as they leave us in the eighth grade. And so it's a very exciting and important conversation that we're having as a staff. Under technology, I'm not going to go into the details, but again, we have been working with our with Ms. Samoz on deciding what elements of technology we need in these classrooms. And pricing those things out and deciding what's the best application. Do we go with a tablet, a netbook, a Chromebook, a Google Chromebook, and finding out what the application best serves our students. Below that, in the physical plant, I never thought I'd be shopping for classroom furniture, but I found myself doing that. The key element that we have discovered in research around STEAM is that each one of those elements, items, there are no desks in the classrooms. It's extremely important that all the furniture is portable, that students are able to work in collaborative groups, but immediately in that class moment, via casters or rolling wheels, they're able to separate individual testing environments. So the class has to be flexible and mobile for both the teachers and the students. Below in the daily schedule and program design, this is where we've started to build some relationships. I have started some consultation with Pam Reichard, who is well known on the coast as a what I have deemed as a STEAM expert and as a practicing middle school teacher. She's guiding many of the Maker Faires and the STEAM Consortium, C-STEM. I have worked with her to run by, and I will do so again this Thursday, decisions around technology, decisions around furniture, to ensure that our expenditures are truly innovative and are truly going to meet the needs of our talk to Morro Bay Parks and Recreation, and believe it or not, they are interested as well in offering some sort of a before or after school program. In partnerships, if we scroll down a little bit, in the short amount of time that we've had, we have made contact with PG&E, who has agreed to start a partnership. They have to establish a partnership before they can start to grant money, and that's where we want to go. So they've agreed to come out and do an energy and program assessment for us, essentially lighting, heating, effectiveness for STEAM in our rooms. And so we have already scheduled that assessment and developed that partnership with PG&E. One of our teachers, Mr. Greg Wilcox, has also met with a fairly new program, the two key professors. Their names are to the right of the document, but not too important for our presentation tonight. But the with Professor David Gillette and Professor Michael Wongs, who both run the the Cal Poly Liberal Arts and Engineering Studies program. It's the second year of the program, and these are students who graduate and go on to work for movie studios, creating sets, plots, designing scripts. They're kind of the creative Pixar people, and it's a very new program at Cal Poly. Mr. Wilcox at our site has already met with these two gentlemen. They are organizing their juniors and seniors to come out to study our existing spaces, specifically our shop spaces, and to analyze how we could transform those into maker areas or tinker areas, which is a key component of discovery. Relates back to Mr. Robinette's analogy of dumping things on a table and creating, which is creating that thinker amongst our students. So we're developing that relationship with Cal Poly partners. In the STEAM area, I wanted again just reemphasize the connection that we've had with Mr. Francisco Fernflores. The consultation with Ms. Pam Reichert, who we've identified as someone who is a practicing STEAM teacher currently at the middle school level and is able to provide us with a great source of knowledge. We've also already had a conference call with Google to discuss with them what the most appropriate application or working hub is for us and for our students. As you know, with Google Docs and Google Forms, those don't require a Word type of program. It allows students also to access it from any web-based computer at home, which is different than an application. So we're exploring MyBigCampus, which we are currently using. We're exploring Google Docs and Google Forms and the Google Educational Suite and trying to determine what will be best for our students. And then in special education, as I mentioned before, I'm able to meet with Ms. Kirk-Martinez. If you could scroll up, I missed one thing before I complete my presentation tonight, Ms. Holmes. Under the area of physical plant, I do think there are some important things that are happening right around the corner. We are deciding on furniture and furniture purchasing, but that can only happen once our rooms, our portable rooms, are ready to accept that furniture. By the 30th of January, which is right around the corner, all of the rooms will be fully recarpeted and refurbished inside. And I thank our building grounds and transportation, Mr. Jeff Guy and Mr. Rick Manderscheid, for making that happen. If you were to come to our school, our exteriors have already started to kind of change shape as well. We've cleared some shrubbery, made some more space for the kids. There's a plan for resurfacing, and we've been able to meet and talk about the detailed plan for the facelift of our facility as well. So progress on that front is going on as well. I've been asked to present a series of these updates, so for tonight, I think it's appropriate with your agenda that we keep it short and that I expose you to the document. We will post this document on our STEAM portion of our website at LOMS, and it will continuously be revised so that people can see the progress that we're making towards implementing the program. At this time, if you have any questions, I'd like to take those.
Marilyn?
Thank you. Dr. Pruitt, I just wondered what kind of response you've had to the openings in terms of teachers wanting to participate in this program.
Yes. Well, first off, I'd like to say I'm excited about the names that are surfacing. I've had phone calls from individual teachers in the district who have called and asked me specific questions about the program. I always like to wait until the day that it closes to check the list because of what we decided to do and to be transparent with the board, we've asked that the internal candidates complete a complete district application so that we can see their historical, their education, what we know is our district application. But the most important document we've asked is for them to create a cover letter explaining why they're interested in attending our site and why they think they're a good fit for our site.
In light of your budget presentation, it looks like a challenge to fund all the bells and whistles we're going to do over here. And one of the questions that I had is, have you guys actually allocated cash to make sure that this thing happens? I know this isn't a discussion, so you don't have to answer, but I would like to see that posted somewhere. June 7th is coming pretty quick. In the December 11th meeting, you guys had all satisfied yourselves on getting behind this program, yet we haven't heard a peep out of anybody about this program since then. We would like a detailed transition plan, and we would also like to know if there is funding allocated to whatever transitional plan we're going to put the kids through to get comfortable with this. And then my last comment is that the second spoke of your steam wheel is technology. I'm in business, and when I think of technology, I think about communication. And for me to have spent countless hours to come down here to meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting and to still have more questions than answers is kind of weird. So I got to thinking about it, and I was thinking that if you guys really want to stand up and teach the children technology, please practice what you preach. We have you have no information on your district site that I can really find. You have a Loam's on the Loam's website. You have a half-built blog with Carl Bloom's 1115 is the last blog entry on there. No resources, no story. I haven't heard a peep from my elementary school about it since. I think you guys need to really step up your social networking. I mean, maybe the newsletter committee or the yearbook committee is now the Facebook committee over there, and you guys have a public page, and you teach the kids how to communicate with all the social media and with all of the technology tools that everybody is doing business today does. We have to do it. We have to teach our kids to use it, and we have to set the example. So I'm asking you guys to please do that. And you've got my email address. Thank you.
Okay, we will move on to item 8.01, issues of capacity and programs at Bishop Speak Teach, and that will be Mr. Robinette. Oh, can you make it?
I'm going for the most popular guy in the room award tonight, talking about budget cuts and now the dilemma of Bishop Speak and Teach. Let me first illustrate, and I'll try to be brief because I know we have concerned people who really, I'm sure, want to address the board. This is a map of the shared campus of Bishop's Peak and Teach Elementary. On the top, it's kind of not visible here. You have Highland Drive, which is one of the access points to the school. Not the, the main access point, but students can come down from that area. The parking structure that comes in from the Bishop's Peak neighborhood is a one-way access, just to familiarize yourself with the school. Thank you, Kim. It's perfect. That goes across the front there, some parking there. Other parking is basically in the neighborhoods. Bishop's Peak and Teach as a joint campus is the smallest classroom footprint of any of our elementary schools, and yet it is, at this point, our largest by enrollment, because we have two schools on that campus. We're over 500 students at this school. Those red classrooms indicate those classes that are part of the Bishop's Peak school, the Bishop's Peak classrooms. The blue ones down in the lower left are the Teach, Charles E. Teach school classrooms. We have a couple of computer labs. That would be room 29, I believe, and room 10, one for Bishop's Peak, one for Teach. We have some joint use classrooms, room 27, 22, 21. We have some after-school programs, science lab, art lab, going in those classes that both schools access. Room 22 is a music room that is pretty much used all day for both campuses. Room 9, it'd be difficult to convert to a classroom. It's actually the faculty lounge, the joint room, and it's kind of right next to a quite small office space, probably the smallest office space of any of our schools. So there's kind of the footprint. That's the campus we're looking at. The little yellow section down there is actually the school garden right now, and on the lower left, it is actually stubbed and ready to add a portable classroom. classroom. That would be the only place when we did our whole Measure A expansion years ago. All the schools were kind of targeted for where they could expand, where you could logically add a portable classroom. That bottomed out fairly recently. In 2008, we kind of reached our lowest level, and we've been growing ever since. The school district's been growing at about a 2% level every year. But Bishop's Peak itself has had a very sharp rise, an 8% increase in population 2 years ago. This last year, a 14% increase in population, in spite of the fact that we virtually closed off open enrollment. We were trying to control the population of students wanting to get into Bishop's Peak from outside the attendance area. It is our fastest growing school. Teach may end up being our fastest growing school because of the interest. So there's an absolute interest in this school, not so much from open enrollment, but from the neighborhood. And we can only conjecture what that's about. There has been some obviously lowering of home prices. It's become kind of a mecca for young families in that neck of the woods. Cal Poly, of course, has added a substantial number of housing units on campus, which has changed along the Foothill Corridor. A lot of what used to be student rental housing is now occupied by families. Whatever the reason, the Bishop's Peak community on its own is growing at a pretty rapid pace. At the pace that we're anticipating it growing, we will need to add 1 to 3 classrooms over the next 1 to 2 years for Bishop's Peak. That's what our early projections are. If we look at Teach Elementary School from a historical perspective, it's an interesting one. It was started about 33 years ago, so it's been in existence a long time. Teach was an alternative program before it was a school. In fact, students who went to this program still kept their old school designation even though they didn't go to that school. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. Back in the early 80s, it was an alternative program for 4th through 6th grade gifted students, GATE students. It wasn't called Teach. It was housed at the Grand Avenue campus, what we sometimes call Old Pacheco. In 1984, the program was expanded to both Sunnyside Elementary in Los Osos and that Grand Avenue campus. And then we stopped that after a couple of years. In 1992, we had kind of the 285 students, and it received the designation Charles Teach, and we moved it to what is now the new Pacheco campus. The school became its own school at its own campus. It was a shared facility with district offices, actually. Our instructional services and student support service or student services buildings were sharing a facility with Teach. Between 1994 and 2001, the numbers began dwindling at Teach and fell below 200 as an alternative program. During this period, the criteria changed for entrance. Students no longer had to achieve a certain test score above the 90th percentile in order to get into Teach school. It was open to all students. In 1992, they received the designation. No, I already got that. Okay. So because of huge budget cuts that were made in 2001, which I alluded to before, the board made a decision of shutting down 3 schools. We closed Sunnyside, Morrill Elementary, and Old Pacheco. And we made the decision to move both the Teach School and the Bishop's Peak School into this one campus. There was conversation at the time of combining the schools and just kind of making one unified school, but the decision was made to keep them distinct entities, separate school codes, separate parent organizations, site councils, separate teaching faculty. Both schools had significant declines in population, so all was well as far as that was concerned. A 38% decline in Teach's population, followed by another 30% decline. And in fact, in 2006-2007, there were only 66 students registered at Teach Elementary. Our projection was that it was going to drop below 60. I remember as personnel director having some hard decisions about, are we going to really have the Teach campus have 2 teachers, 1 4th-5th grade combo teacher and 1 5th-6th grade combo teacher, because the projection was that we would have less than 60 students in the 2007-08 school year. There were some staffing changes made, and Teach had a huge renaissance in interest, and it's been reflected in a growing population ever since. In 2011-12, we reached 151 students at Teach Elementary. Because of the population admission issues at both schools. We held a lottery for the first time last year, limiting space at Teach Elementary to 50 slots so that we can accommodate the Bishop's Peak growth. There is no question that Teach is now a very popular magnet school in our district. So it's a dilemma. And I would suggest maybe looking at this dilemma through maybe three different lenses, and they're all lenses you could choose to look at or not. One is just enrollment and population. I mean, what do we do anytime we have a school growing or shrinking? We have decisions to make. A second one is housing two schools on one campus, that curriculum's intended for access to all. So does the Teach model advocate access to all? It is a distinguished school. It is a nationally recognized school with incredible academic success. But does it reflect the district diversity in our English learner population, our special education problem population, our socioeconomically disadvantaged students? So just another lens to look at. We've put before the board six options. Now, there are probably multitudes of options of what to do, but I have a feeling there are variations of these themes. We're not asking the board to make any decisions about this tonight because public input is vitally important here. But let me just kind of quickly go through those options. One is to make use of all the space. We do have lab spaces that could be altered and changed into classroom spaces. We do have a portable pad that could, the garden could be displaced and we could put a classroom there. There are some transportation and safety issues because of the school getting large. I know neighbors, we get letters. Neighbors are concerned about that space, but expanding the capacity at Bishop's Peak and Teach Elementary is certainly a possibility. We could reboundary. If we were to change the boundaries of the Bishop's Peak community, it would probably be to send more students to Sensheimer Elementary. Reboundering changes usually take about 5 years until you kind of see the fruits of them because it's very difficult to tell, you know, a third grader you're going to a new school. Usually you grandfather in students who are already there, and you, over time, with kindergarten enrollment and new students, kind of shift those boundaries. We could restrict students at Teach Elementary through lottery and restrict it even more. As Bishop's Peak grows, we could restrict down to 30 students or get to a place where Teach is at a size that we can manage on both campuses in spite of its popularity. We could move the Teach campus off-site. And I know a lot of the letters and things the board has received is to look at an alternative campus for this program, to move to one of our campuses that we have closed, Pacheco, Moro Elementary, Sunnyside, to move to the district office, or to somehow reconfigure that program. Obviously, there are costs involved in those kinds of decisions, and we are, if we move to one of our sites that we're currently renting out space, there would be some kind of a loss of revenue. So it's a consideration the board would have to be look at in terms of cost. We could phase out Teach. Probably not a popular decision for a lot of the people behind me, but if you wanted to diminish a program, just don't offer it in fourth grade. It doesn't affect students who are currently in the program, fifth grade the next year, sixth grade the following year. Obviously, there'd be some philosophy behind that decision. Or you could, another option would be to somehow absorb the two schools into one, combine the Bishop's Peak and Teach communities, try to take the best of both worlds, and create a neighborhood school that students can open enrollment into to the degree that it was available. I'm not sure there would be much open enrollment available, but to have the faculty create a program for one school on one campus. Both schools are excellent schools. They have APIs above 900. Both Bishop's Peak and Teach Elementary are in the top 5% academically in the state. So we would like the board to make a decision quickly, obviously not tonight, but fairly expediently, because we're scheduled to begin open enrollment, our lottery processes, our kindergarten roundup February 25th. I mean, it's kind of where our timeline is. We have staffing decisions, class allocations. In light of budget things, we have to consider where we're going to put teachers. So if possible, we'd like to have marching orders by February 19th so we can kind of move on. Very interested, obviously, in public comment as you are, and any board discussion or direction you would give us on any of those options to explore some, to not explore others, anything you'd like to send us off on working on tonight would be appropriate. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robinette. I think what we'll do, since everybody's been so patient, is we'll move to public comment. And what we've done in the past is we'll have one person who is going to be speaking and then another person kind of on deck, excuse the sports metaphor. What we've also found useful, since we don't want, you know, loud demonstrations and things, if you agree with the point of view raised by a speaker, if you want to raise your hand, it helps the board visualize who's, you know, with you on that point of view and that opinion. You get a little tired over time, but it does help us. So. And we're going to hold you strictly to 3 minutes because we have a lot of people who would like to speak. And with that, Mr. Questenberry, would you go ahead and tell us the name of the first person and then number two person?
Mr. Millar, we have two requests to speak. The first person I would like to...
Elite private high schools. Both are undeniably smart and well-educated and owe much of their success to the strong foundation laid by excellent schools. Every motivated, high-potential young American deserves a similar opportunity, but the majority of very smart kids lack the wherewithal to enroll in rigorous private schools. They depend on public education to prepare them for life. Yet that system is failing to create enough opportunities for hundreds of thousands of these high-potential girls and boys. Mostly the system ignores them, with policies and budget priorities that concentrate on raising the floor under low-achieving students. A good and necessary thing to do, yes, but we fail to raise the ceiling for those already well above the floor. Public education's neglect of high-ability students doesn't just deny individuals opportunities they deserve. It also imperils the country's future supply of scientists, inventors, and entrepreneurs. Here and there, however, entire public schools focus exclusively on high-ability, highly motivated students. Critics call them elitists, but we found the opposite. These are great schools accessible to families who can't afford private schooling or expensive suburbs. The schools we studied, by and large, are educational oases for families with smart kids but few alternatives. Many more students could benefit from schools like these, and the numbers would multiply if our educational system did right by such students in the early grades. But that will happen only when we acknowledge that leaving no child behind means paying as much attention to those who have mastered the basics and have the capacity and motivation for much more, as we do to those who cannot yet read or subtract. It's time to end the bias against gifted and talented education and quit assuming that every school must be all things to all students, a simplistic formula that ends up neglecting all sorts of girls and boys, many of them poor and minority, who would benefit more from specialized public schools. America should have 1,000 or more high schools for able students, not 165, and elementary and middle schools that, spot and prepare their future pupils. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Robin O'Leary.
Hi. My name is Robin O'Leary. I am a parent of a young student at Teach School, a very happy young man, I must tell you. He is in Miss Robson's class, but he has Mr. Crab for math, adores them both. So we have a problem here, and that is that Teach and Bishop's Peak are impacted. Anybody who's been there during drop-off and pickup realizes that this is a difficult situation for the community around the school. It's not going to be an easy solution, but I would urge you to keep Teach School. And if you can, to expand the program. Teach School is valuable to our community. It's not just valuable to my child. It's not just valuable to the children of the parents in this room. It is valuable to our community. These are kids that this is their only opportunity in elementary school for accelerated learning. I got on the phone in the past 2 days and called every district in this county. If we eliminate Teach School, we have no accelerated learning. We will be one of the only districts in this county with no accelerated learning opportunities for elementary school kids. That's it. Lucia Marr, Paso Robles, who even has a huger budget deficit than we do, has a GATE program, because I talked to them today. Nearly every other school district has this. Without a program like Teach in Place, we will not be on par with our neighboring districts. There is quite a bit of research regarding accelerated learning. For example, in 2001, the Journal of Applied Psychology reported that children in accelerated learning programs, 71% report satisfaction with their education. The majority of those who were unsatisfied because it was not accelerated enough. They were bored. The popularity of Teach is indicated by the fact that the current fourth grade had so much interest that a lottery was held to determine admittance. Wouldn't it be nice to meet the needs of every single student in this district, whether they need to catch up or want to accelerate? It is a diverse student population. We have students who are culturally, economically, and emotionally and academically diverse. Kids don't have to test to get in to Teach. What the students do have in common is that they are all thriving in this accelerated learning environment. That's it. That's it. There is no difference between them and any of their other peers. But this is the perfect environment for them. They are square pegs, finally in a square hole. Many students feel that at Teach they are validated, they are affirmed, they have an affiliation with like-minded, motivated students, and they have a communion with them. Their response, my response for your board options. Options 1 through 3 are really not feasible. They lessen the ability of the site to uphold any STEAM program by impacting those other classrooms. 5 and 6 negatively impact our current students. But the future of and the future of the district. With no other resource in place for accelerated learning, the district would not be meeting the needs of all of its students. More important resource for our students. I know that our children would be heartbroken and our families would be heartbroken if Teach were not allowed to continue, but we would be thrilled if it could expand. And you would have the support of many, many people here, I'm sure. Thank you.
Thank you. Please come forward and state your name.
My name is Edona Cabrina. Good evening, board members and Superintendent Dr. Prater, Assistant Superintendent Mr. Robinette and Mr. Miller and Ms. Holmes, and families of Bishop's Peak and Teach families and other guests. My name is Edona Cabrina. I am a parent to 2 children at both schools. One is in first grade at Bishop's Peak. The other is a fifth grader at Teach. And if I say that fast, I'll get them confused, so I have to read it slowly here. I am also Booster's president of Teach School and a member of the PTA at Bishop's Peak. And I was trying to calculate with the $7 million deficit, maybe all the schools in the district, if we held 400 carnivals, we would raise $7 million, because our Bishop's Peak PTA raised close to $21,000, right? Something like that. Anyways, I was standing here last October, standing along with many Teach parents to congratulate the board and superintendent for having Teach becoming a national blue ribbon school in the county. This evening, I share with you the importance of you making it possible to serve the needs of all students. If you as board members will at least look at Dr. Prater's board doc statements and already remove number 5 as an option, that would be a wise decision. I understand it's the elephant in the room. It needs to be said. Let's get it out of the room and say it will. We will phase in something else if it's not there. But that statement alone, I think, is just... I'm sensitive to the fact that Teach's history brings an emotional roller coaster of feelings, both positive and negative, to the district. I understand that Teach School, for some in the past and perhaps in the present, brings mixed feelings. But in terms of fostering education and a lifelong learning approach for all, Teach School is an invaluable environment for providing a rich, nourishing place of instruction, experience, and diversified approaches to learning. First, I ask you to not change a thing. Keep our school vibrant and alive. Keep Bishop's Peak vibrant and alive. Oh, and speaking of vibrant and alive, please note that yellow spot next to 29 was designated garden, but it is actually more clearly to the left of that. That long rectangle is the garden. I work in the garden and lead all kinds of fun stuff there, as many of these parents do too. That yellow part was founded by, I believe, if I'm not misspeaking, Bishop's Peak and Teach parents working for an outside classroom. And if any of you were to go there, you'd have to just think twice before you would plant a portable on there. But just behind that is a lot of green grass and behind the big tree, and I'm sure a portable or two would fit there. So First, I ask you to not change a thing, keep our schools vibrant and alive. It currently serves 155 students. As we've heard, it's extremely popular. It's had its first lottery. It's gained popularity, and students are enrolling through the district's open enrollment policy. That sounds like access for all. Second, if something has to change, make Teach School be more inclusive. Let us conscientiously go out to other schools. Let us, the district here working for us, go out to other schools within the district and seek to include students who would benefit from the academic richness this school has to offer. Thirdly, can the district truly follow through on its initiatives that are so popularly discussed, displayed, although not actually conveyed in not even 50% of its schools? I understand you have accelerated learning in the high school level, but what
Could
do we
please
have?
Conclude?
Okay.
Thank you.
Fourth, the district has created its own challenges with the open enrollment policy and with closure of schools and redistricting the school boundaries, making Bishop's Peak Elementary serving families on this side of town, including all the way to Ellis Street by French Hospital. Even if described as a ripple effect, it is important the district revisit all the elementary school boundaries. In the past 10 years, enrollment has overall increased. Granted,
Thank you.
This district
Thank
is
you.
Heavily
Thank you very
based
much.
On Bishop's Peak enrollment.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. Did you want to speak? Please, come forward.
Hi, my name is Elisa Piet. I have two children, one in seventh grade at Laguna and one in fourth in Teach. I didn't write anything, so I just want to briefly say that my daughter, who started at Teach this year, has never loved school as much as she does right now. She has been bored. She's not liked going to school. She has wanted to stay home more days than not at her other school. My other daughter was fine at the other school. It was great. She had a fine experience. My daughter was open to trying Teach as an option, and we are so grateful for Mr. Crabb's class. She can't wait to go to school. I mean, some days, of course, she'd like to stay home, but what kid doesn't? She's excited about school. She's energized about school. She's motivated in a new way. She's reading more than she ever has. The environment is so positive for her. It is high-quality instruction, which I believe was number one on your list. And that's what that school has to offer. And then just in the budget, I question the $8 million that you have in development fees that's for growth issues and new schools and how that money can be used. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Lisa Guy. I have a son at Bishop's Peak in sixth grade. And I wanted to thank you all for your time. What an amazing amount of work that's been going on. Rick Robinette, beautiful presentation of the budget. I came tonight wanting to really advocate for having two separate schools. I think it would benefit the students and the teachers of both Bishop's Peak and Teach. But now I'm pretty concerned about where's the money going to come from. So I did want to mention Dan Block had talked to me at one point. He's our principal at Bishop's Peak, about the idea of merging the two schools and having different pathways. And I think that that's something that should be looked at. I think that there are different students with different interests and aptitudes. And if there was the option of having an accelerated path that certain students could take and other students could be accelerated in different areas, I think we really need to look at that. And I'd like to see that in all of our schools, actually. Thank you.
Would anyone else like to speak to the board on this issue? Hi. Come on up. Don't hesitate. Hi.
My name is Jackie Evers, and I am an alumni of Teach. I attended in the early 80s, and I have three children. I have a seventh grader at Laguna, I have a fourth grader at Teach, and I have a kindergartner at C.L. Smith. My seventh grader attended C.L. Smith. It was an excellent school for her. And when she reached about third grade, she became bored. Her friends were doing things that they clearly weren't interested in school. She didn't fit in. She didn't make friends well. She cried a lot at night. And so I considered Teach. I actually attended Teach, and I hated it when I was there in fifth grade. I missed almost every single Monday. It was so hard. But I looked back at what I actually took from it that I've carried on, and I went through Cuesta Community College. I went away. I have a teaching credential. I'm now a special education teacher. I have a master's. I've reached the top of the pay scale, and I'm looking at going back to school this year. And I know that motivation, that love of learning, it came from Teach. And I want my children to have that too. My seventh grader went to Teach after having just crying and everything in third grade. She made friends. She had best friends. She had close friends, and she fit in. Somebody earlier tonight said it was like finally the square peg fit in the square hole. And that's what it did for my daughter. And I'm very grateful for it.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Ridley, Bishop's Peak second grade parent, and a preschooler to come in the future. First, I'd like to reiterate about the outdoor classroom. It is very much an outdoor classroom, not simply a portable pad. Many, many years have been spent and so much time and energy making that into what it is today, and I'm sure if you went out to see it, you wouldn't even consider putting a portable on it. It's used daily. It's used for the garden curriculum, but it's also used by the classroom teachers in their everyday curriculum, and it is a very important thing to both Teach and Bishop's Peak schools. I also have a couple of comments from Teach alumni to read for you. From Giuseppe DeFranco of Giuseppe's in San Luis Obispo, he's a manager of the family business. He said, "Teach changed my life, and it got me through to today." We also have another email that we received from a Teach alum, Miranda Bagg, who graduated SLO High School in 2002. She says, "I received the best education at Teach rather than at any other higher-level school I attended, including the four-year college I graduated from. At Teach, I was consistently challenged and excited to learn. The school and staff fostered the adaptability in my attitude, built communication skills to succeed, and gave me real-time life experience as a young, vulnerable age. The mentality of the school and curriculum was set up to prepare students for college, from constructing an essay to creative writing and art to science and mathematics, etc. I learned more in my time at Teach than in junior high and high school. I have always been the top of my class, and I credit that drive more to Teach than to my personality or environment. When I have children, there is no doubt in my mind that I will look for a school comparable to Teach Elementary." Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. And anyone else? Okay. Oh, go ahead. Don't drive home regretting that you didn't get up. That's, okay. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Beth Compton. I have a Bishop's Peak student in fifth grade in Mrs. Reddy's class. And I also have a seventh grader who also went through Bishop's Peak school. Others. My seventh grader, now both kids have been given the opportunity to go ahead in math each year. So when they were in fourth grade, they took fifth grade math. When they were in fifth, they were in sixth grade math. And last year, my son, as a sixth grader, was the only student in Mr. Hill's seventh grade class that they set aside a program for him to do for that, and was extremely challenged. So I'm just here to just represent Bishop's Peak and just to say what a wonderful school it is and what it has offered both my children. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Rachel Morgan. I have a fourth grader at Bishop's Peak, and we have enjoyed the experience very much. I'm also a neighbor of Bishop's Peak, first house down the drive. And just in expanding the school, I'm fearful of the danger it could cause. We see a lot of double parking in the driveways, people not stopping at the stop sign at the base right next to my house. So I see that every day. So, and it is very crowded on every side. It's every section that comes near that school, it's very crowded. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Penny Doherty, and I have twin sons. One's at Bishop's Peak and one's at Teach. And We live in Morro Bay. If you wanted to put it in Morro Bay, I'd be really happy. But I don't really care where you put it. Please keep it. It's such a phenomenal thing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Hi. I'm Sherry Brown, and I'm an educator, and I have four children. My oldest is a senior, and she's in special ed, and she has struggled all the way through school, and I feel like I've spent 13 years fighting for her to get a fair education. And then I have a ninth grader at the high school, and she's done great. She did great at our home school and never had a problem. I have a son who's in fourth grade at Teach, and I could tell in second and third grade that he needed more of a challenge. And so, once again, I feel like I'm now fighting for my son who's on the other end of the spectrum, who needs to be pushed, he needs to be challenged. And I didn't want to keep him in a regular classroom where he was just given more work. That wasn't my idea of challenging him or making learning fun and interesting for him. And he's in Miss Robson's class at Teach, and he has Mr. Crab for math. And he comes home every day with a sparkle in his eye, excited about what he learned, can't wait to tell me everything he did at school that day, and just how they incorporate technology into things, and they're making their movies, and all just the fun things they're doing. He doesn't even realize that he's learning. It's so exciting for him, and I think Teach is invaluable, and I think you'd be doing our community and our children a disservice if we didn't find a way to keep it and expand it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. All right. There you go. Okay.
Good evening to everyone. My name is Mary Lou Ube, and I have a son at Teach who's fifth grade, and he is just enjoying his time over there. And I have also fourth grader that I have. It was very disappointing to be left out because they did a lottery, and he is as intelligent as his brother is. But I'm just really disappointed and so sad that he was not given the same opportunity because there was so many students and was not given that same challenge that his brother is enjoying now, pushing to the limits and, you know, just benefiting from what Teach has to offer. And I just highly consider, I mean, encourage you, all of you, please, to just expand or just allow all the kids to have that opportunity and to have a fair and to enjoy the same opportunity as anyone at Teach. And because he was really crying and he was really, really sad. And I hope that you would keep it and give all the students the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Sherry Love, and I am out in Los Osos, and I have a fourth grader in Teach. And I wanted to let you know that we really, really struggled with this decision. We love our homeschool, and it wouldn't have taken us much to stay there. But I really appreciated the parents talking about the opportunities at Bishop's Peak, because those are opportunities I would have liked to have. I wanted a challenge, but we weren't offered the opportunity for him to do accelerated math or go to a different class, or he was just sort of... And he's a very motivated guy. Like, my younger one does not, it's a different experience, let's just put it that way. But he's motivated. And then when he started acting out in class, I was like, what? You know, this isn't working for him. And I won't say that he latched on to Teach right away. I mean, it was a big homework jump for him, and he's struggled, and it's been a struggle, but he's kind of getting the groove now. And part of him going there was I wanted him to learn to overcome a challenge and to let him know that he's not always going to be the top. You know, when he came home, he's like, Mom, I got a 92%, and, you know, and it's like, it's okay. but he was devastated. And I don't want him to go through the world thinking that it's easy. I want him to have that challenge. And what I love, too, and I didn't think about it when I sent him there, is that he has an identity that's bigger than I'm just the best student at math. You know, he gets to, like he says, I get to joke around and have this other, like, I want him to know that there's music and there's art and he can be, you know, a bigger person than just, like, the smart kid. And I don't say that to be arrogant, because I would always tell him there's other people that are just as motivated and challenged. And so I'm so glad he's there. And I just, I see the impact at Bishop's Peak, and I just hope that you continue the TEACH program. And I would just say that our family's dedication to our local school is that my partner, my husband, who is a chemist, still does the fourth grade enrichment program at our home school. So we are very committed to creating enrichment experiences, even at our home school, even if it doesn't directly benefit our kids. We really care about our community, and I hope that we can even reach some of the Spanish-speaking families who didn't know, like we'll talk to other families, and they didn't know about TEACH. And yet I could see their kids would really benefit. So for me, it's about doing the outreach and making it open and bringing in the community, and that's really important to me. So thank you. I didn't know if I'd make it back in time, so I'm so glad to have had this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Well, no, come on up.
My name is Stacy Thacker, and I have a student at Bishop's Peak and a student at TEACH. They're twin boys in the fifth grade. And both schools, I have to start off saying, are wonderful. And both boys have thrived at both schools. The son that's at TEACH is here tonight, and he's here because he's concerned about his school. He loves his school. He loves learning. He loves the challenge of it. One of the observations I wanted to share tonight in listening to the presentation that went on previously about teaching children to think through their decisions and not just to memorize and to learn, I see that happening a great deal at TEACH. And rather than doing away with a school that's already doing something we're aspiring to, why not keep that school, grow that school, and have that school teach some of those skills and traits to the other schools in the district? So I guess I'm asking, don't do away with the program. Find a place for it. If it's not at Bishop's Peak, another place where it will continue to thrive.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public comment. No, I'm not. Okay.
Go ahead. I'll make it brief. I'm a parent of a fifth grade student at TEACH in Ms. Erin Bailey's class, and she's doing a fantastic job this year. My son's excelling underneath her. He is a gifted student.
What's your name, sir?
Bill Struble.
We're making a record here in video.
Okay. I just want to say that, you know, it's not only TEACH a source of pride for all the parents that have students there now, but everyone you talk to in the community that went to that school themselves, they have young children that they're planning on taking there. It really is a gem. It really is a pride of the community. And I don't mean just San Luis Obispo. I mean the whole Central Coast, the whole school district, everyone that goes there. I have a coworker that went to TEACH when he was younger, obviously at least 20 years ago. But if anything that needs to happen with TEACH, it needs to be expanded, not considered as something to potentially get rid of. Dan Block does a wonderful job of running the Bishop Peak and TEACH campus. Anyone that watches opening and closing a school can tell that. The teachers are great. The campuses ran great. But TEACH needs to be somewhere, whether it's at its current location or somewhere else. But this isn't something that should go away. And anyone that thinks that it's something that should go away should hang their head in shame.
Thank you.
Hi. I'm really nervous, so I've been trying to get the courage to come up here. My name is Jamie Wampler, and I have a fourth grade student at Baywood. Fifth grade student at Baywood. When he was in fourth grade, he was offered the opportunity to go to TEACH, and I chose to leave him at Baywood because we love our school. But every year I see a disparity for him, and every year he's getting more bored in regular classroom. He's a square peg, and he doesn't fit. And I'm so worried about him now because I didn't make the choice to send him four. And I think that you should keep TEACH, and you should expand TEACH for kids like my son. He is the smartest boy in his class, and he doesn't fit because none of the other boys are as smart as him, and he doesn't feel like he fits. So he's been at Baywood since kindergarten. He has virtually no friends to hang out with, and he's a really nice kid. So I think you should keep Teach and expand Teach for kids like my son and other kids who don't fit in a round classroom. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we're going to close the public comment period. I first of all want to thank you all for the input and your patience and staying to let us hear from you. Also, I want to thank all you letter writers out there. It's good to see that Britain Communication is alive and well. And I want you to know that the board members take pains to read those letters from you, and it makes a difference for us. So thank you. So now we'll bring it back to the board for board discussion. Anyone? Mark.
Okay. I thought I'd just share with, first of all, I'd also like to thank all of you for coming, for your dedication to your school, and for all the letters that we've gotten. And I really appreciate the input. I took the opportunity, I can't remember, this week to go by Bishop's Peak Teach Campus, particularly to look at the traffic situation and the drop-off. And I have to tell you, I was scared. I parked down below, and I started to walk up, and there was this mass of cars that came. And then I watched as it was turned into gridlock. And there's two concerns that I had. One was for the neighbors, and what would happen if somebody needed an emergency vehicle. And the second concern was for the school site, and what would happen if they needed an emergency vehicle, because there was no way anybody was getting up there. And I walked up to Highland, and that was also impacted. And I have to say that it was really, really nice to see a lot of the parents walk down onto campus and walk their children up to Highland. That was a really sweet thing. I am amazed at the patience that the parents have as they drive through and drop off and pick up their children. That's got to take a lot of effort. I'm also scared, and I also feel that something needs to be done. So I want to add that to the discussion, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit the school.
I have some questions for staff. My first one would be about the portable situation at the spaces for portables. You say there's one space where a portable could be planted. What is the criteria for that? Because it's a very spacious campus, as you know. But why do we think there's one space only for a portable?
Essentially, what you do for putting a portable a school site is you prepare for the infrastructure to accept it, the electrical, the plumbing, the different pieces that make it habitable. It has to be level. It has to have clearances, those kinds of things. When we did Measure A, we constructed to a capacity, and we had many, many meetings. I wasn't there, but this is my understanding, that established capacity for different school sites based upon their land size. And when we did that, where you see the Teach portables, those were prepared pads at the time in order to accept 600, now 550 because of class size reduction, students. And that's why you have 8 portable pads that were prepared.
So if the additional one were added, that would take it to 600. The population could be 600. That could be accommodated.
Actually, it's now 550, and we're squeezing along with what we have.
525.
So if an additional portable were added,
right.
Though, so how would we get it to 600 is my question.
I don't think we can, because unless we increase class sizes, because we're at our contractual limit essentially.
Lab spaces. You could convert.
Well, you could eliminate the labs, and you can eliminate the computer labs and the special use classrooms, and you could add, but the primary dictate from the board was to have special purpose classrooms as part of the design criteria for the school, mm-hmm. which included labs and such classrooms.
But it's but you're saying it is possible though to make more clearance. That it just involves more an expense, but it could be done. That's what I'm unclear about. Why can other land on the campus not be used for portables? If it were clear,
you can.
You can.
Sure.
That's my question. Okay.
You can plant them in the playground. You can plant them in the parking lot. You can plant them wherever you choose to do so.
So, and the question that was raised by one of the speakers about the $8 million that we have in developers' fees, which is for the purpose of overcrowding, could that be used?
Actually, it's not for overcrowding. It's for growth purposes, and it's very strictly enforced. In this particular case, you have a specially designed program, and the program expansion doesn't meet the criteria for use of developer fees.
What about the growth of Bishop's Peak as a neighborhood school?
The current Bishop's Peak, if we had, and we have had growth there, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Then there could be a justification for the use of developer fees to accommodate growth for Bishop's Peak.
Okay. Thank you for that. And so the other question I have has to do with traffic. And I certainly am well aware of the traffic issues there. It seems as though it was a very poorly designed school site to begin with. Even this, when it was a very, very small school, there was not enough room to park. So my question would be, somebody wrote us a letter, I'm sorry I can't acknowledge who you are, that has some very innovative ideas about talking about the transportation piece of it, mass transportation ideas, parking off campus. And it did occur to me that at Laguna Middle School, for example, a number of parents will drop their students off across the street at the golf course, and the students walk across with the park with the traffic person, and that accomplishes a great drop-off situation, which makes it much more less crowded at Laguna Middle School. It seems to me as though a similar situation could occur, for example, at the Latter-day Saints Church, right on Foothill Boulevard, which is within walking distance of Bishop's Peak Teach Schools. If we could arrange some kind of bus drop-off or parent drop-off or commuter drop-off, because Teach is a commuter school, and Bishop's Peak, even though most of the people live in the community, we've now expanded the boundary in recent years so far from Bishop's Peak. It probably does require being dropped off. So that I just would like someone to speak to. Is that a feasible idea? Maybe Mr. Guy would need to speak to that. But just another way to approach addressing the traffic issues and the neighborhood issues that are caused by the number
Great
of
Great idea.
Okay. Well, thank you.
I mean, every school has transportation issues primarily before school and after school, and they institute different mitigation measures along the way. And clearly, each school has a personality about its traffic, and this Bishop's Peak Teach school site is rather unique in its isolation, if you will, from arterial streets. Mm-hmm. So coming up with an innovative practice in order to mitigate that is a great idea.
So what I'm trying to address here are trying to knock down a few of the obstacles that we have at the moment to either allowing Bishop's Peak and Teach to remain where they are, or even possibly to grow. So I think we've addressed a couple of those issues of the possibility of using funds to add another portable or two or three, or the possibility of mitigating some of the traffic issues on the neighborhood and so forth like that. The other question I have is, how recently was the expansion of the Bishop's Peak school district? That was just a few years ago. It was just 3 or 4 years ago.
The expansion of
the Bishop's Peak.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood
boundaries.
Your question. That happened in 2002, I think. 2003?
It's been quite recent to me, in my mind.
I believe that we did the redistricting of that whole area when we chose to close Old Pacheco School. So there was that redistricting. We looked at the Sensheimer area, and I
Hawthorne.
Believe we also looked at Hawthorne as well. And then there was later on, we looked at Los Ranchos versus Sensheimer as well a couple of years after that.
And Ed was the assistant superintendent at the time because he had his great joke about carrying water in a pail with a hole in it, trying to bring this to a planning consensus. And so that's why I say 2003. Okay.
I'm feeling like it might have even been more recent than that because I'm thinking it's been around like 2004 or 5 because I know that the neighborhood where I live was previously a Sensheimer neighborhood. Yeah. Do you believe so? Okay.
We'll research that one.
And my only reason for raising that issue is that in some ways, we brought this growth upon ourselves by redistricting to include that such a large geographical area for Bishop's Peak, which, of course, has led to that growth. But also, I think I'd like some input on how many parents take advantage of open enrollment to enter their child into kindergarten at Bishop's Peak so that, and then later transfer them to Teach. So I think there's in the past, what I've heard from Bishop's Peak teachers is that is a fairly sizable part of the community.
Yeah, it used to be, and I think because of the growth in the Bishop's Peak community, naturally less so because we're not allowing it. I mean, we capped kindergarten enrollment and kept those mostly at neighborhood schools just because of that issue. But yeah, you're absolutely right. There was a I think in years past, a pretty strong predilection of some parents to put their students to open enroll into the Bishop's Peak community at the kindergarten or first grade level so that they'd establish relationships with peers with the intent of then going to teach elementary in the fourth grade. And I think that's been happening since we combined the schools.
Right. I agree. And so I'm getting at that because I'm thinking that if we're trying to contain the growth of the school, one thing is to look at that is the number of students we allow to transfer in as kindergartners into Bishop's Peak, and then of course we've already been doing the lottery at Teach. I'm trying to propose ideas that are less drastic than a few of these on this list, and I think there are solutions that we can come up to which are creative, innovative, which honor our commitment as a board to our fifth initiative, sixth initiative, which is offering accelerated opportunities for all of our students. And one of the things that we forget is that one of these Richard DeFore essential questions is not just, are we, you know, what are we doing, how are we teaching, how are we answering the question, but also, what are we doing for students when they get it? When they already get what we're teaching, how are we raising the ceiling, as someone read from the New York Times today? And that is also about accelerated learning opportunities. They're not the idea of raising the floor, they're not mutually exclusive. We can accomplish both. And I know, in the interest of disclosure for the rest of you in here, I have two children who went through Teach. One of them also went through Bishop's Peak, and I'm very fond of both schools. It's a wonderful site. It's a great experience for children at both schools, and so I have to admit to that. But I also want to just say to my fellow board members that I am available to you as a resource. I hope that we can have this conversation and not make it about past history, but make it about what we're trying to accomplish as a board with our initiatives, with our population, and be responsive to the people who are speaking to us tonight, and know that each of those people represent many, many more voices in the community. Thank you.
Yeah, just a couple of questions. As one who lives two blocks from Sunnyside and has seen how that campus has been reconfigured for various tenants, you mentioned that the a sizable financial commitment. Have we really kind of ballparked that at all for any of the sites? Because I assume that what's happened at Sunnyside is also true about El Moro and Old Pacheco.
We haven't really got ballparked it, okay? So I'll tell you that it would take something to the tune of $25,000 to $35,000 at an existing Sunnyside Morrill Elementary to per classroom to convert furniture, things that have deteriorated over time, playground, office space, those kinds of issues.
And Teach currently occupies
five classrooms and a computer lab.
Okay, thank you.
Well, also the cost of running a site when we closed them was $250,000. It was roughly a principal, secretary, custodian.
Somewhere between $350,000 and $500,000 for the administrative aspects of staffing the school.
And then the cost would also include a loss of revenue from tenants that we currently rent to.
To the extent that we dislocate existing payers, then we'd have to calculate that.
Okay. Do you want? Pardon me? Oh, thank you. Chris?
I don't have a solution for this, and I appreciate the six. I'm not sure which one or if any of them I'm in favor of. The one thing, though, I do think we need to look at is I think we need to look at redistricting, going back to doing that. I think we might need to do an update, though, on a demographic study if we're going to be looking at that. It's been 5 or 6 years since we've done that. I think the Bishop's Peak area is clearly large, probably larger than we want it to be. I think the Sensheim area is probably smaller than we need it to have, although, you know, at the time, Sensheim was the largest elementary school that we had. Clearly, Bishop's Peak is now Bishop's Peak Teach. I share the same concerns you do, Walter, about moving a new school, about opening a new school site, not just the cost of creating the school site, but also the administrative and the ongoing costs, which we learned the hard way when we closed the three schools. And, yeah, at the time it was $250,000. I'm hearing $800,000. And that's $800,000 ongoing. Is that correct?
Yeah, it would be. Yes.
Okay. I don't have any choices here, except that I will also say that I don't believe we can continue to grow Teach on that site. I think it's unfair for the community in that area. And I can't see how putting more classrooms in that small space is going to help the school or the students at that school.
I'm going to go first since Mark's already had a turn. First of all, I reject the notion that accelerated learning, good teaching, is only going on at Teach and maybe Bishop's Peak. It happens at all of our sites. I had my son, who's now 27, attended fourth grade at Bishop's Peak or at Teach, and at that time there was academic requirements, recommendation by a teacher, and approval by the principal to enter the school. One of the things that troubles me about the current Teach situation is there really isn't that requirement. I also have always had a problem with and voted against the idea of having two separate schools on one school campus. I think it's corrosive. I think it's injurious to students, some students. And what we really are about is providing the learning opportunities, differentiated learning, to all of our students. And I don't care about floors and ceilings. We have just as much of a moral obligation to accelerate, challenge, invigorate, and embrace all of our students. And the dilemma for the board is how do we do that? How do we do it fairly? So I have a problem with it. I'm more in favor of option 5 or option 6. I had a long conversation with a wonderful man, Ziad Nakasha, who is a vociferous proponent of Teach School and also a colleague. After my right arm healed, but he said some very important things. He said, whatever we do, what we're doing at Teach needs to continue happening, even if it's happening at Bishop's Peak. What's happening at Bishop's Peak needs to keep happening at our other schools, too, and it does. So I guess I don't see this as a, you know, we're going to ruin one group of kids' educational opportunities to do something to assist other kids. It's really in Dr. Prater's initiatives, and, you know, it must be frustrating for some of you parents who express this idea that somehow the student initiatives and what we've been working on and our staff has been working on so diligently in these 10 initiatives is somehow just kind of, you know, graphics to put up on the screen or to put on the front of our handouts or things. It's not true. It is the lifeblood of this district, and it is what drives and motivates these folks up here and many of the folks in the audience tonight, staff and teachers. I know it's what drives Mr. Crabb. And we have that asset at every one of our sites. And I believe that with Dr. Prater's guidance and the energy and drive of our staff, teachers, and clerical, that we will continue to spread this kind of differentiated quality learning to all of our sites. You saw the proposed budget savings looking at counseling. I think that's a huge mistake. I think we could undo a lot of what we accomplish in our good learning environments and our good classrooms and that happened for kids, self-esteem for kids. We could harm that more by cutting counseling in our programs than we will by reconfiguring Teach. If, you know, regardless of what the decision is, I cannot favor expanding Teach to another school site. I think financially it's short-sighted. It denies the realities that were covered pretty extensively by Mr. Robinette earlier this evening. These are the Hobson's choice that, you know, makes it fun to be a school board member. You know, Chris and I laid off people because of a financial situation that happened in 2000. And personally, I'm a conservative person, and I'm on guard about having to do that to programs again in the future. That is, laying people off. Because those people are the people who are delivering these educational gains and the excitement that so many of you express for your kids. And I want to have it for all the kids. So I'm torn. I'm struggling with it. I want to see, as Ziad said, whatever we do, let's not lose what we're doing right at Teach, and let's make sure we do it right everywhere else. Thank you. Mark?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Millar. As I listen to the presentations tonight, Robin O'Leary's comments about calling around to other districts and before Teach and earlier in the concept of gifted and talented, there were other models. There are other models in this district, other models in neighboring districts, other models around the state and country. So as I listen to Robin, to Robin's comments, I heard that there are gifted and talented programs within our county. I'm sort of interested in what those models look like, whether they're the same as Teach or whether they're within each school site, whether they're within each classroom. When we get our API scores, there's a comparable section of that that's comparable schools that looks at the demographics, looks at the teaching staff, looks at the population, and maybe getting some information from those districts as well and looking at what they're doing with gifted and talented, because I think what we're looking at is a single model, and there may be other models that also work. And so if we could get some information on that, I would appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Ellen, and then we'll, she's already gone.
It, A concern appears to be that many gifted and talented children that teach is the only opportunity available to them. So I would like to know, and I disagree with that premise, I will state. I'm a parent of two children who were each referred to attend Teach, and we chose to keep them in the neighborhood school for a variety of reasons, one of which, a primary reason for us, was the diversity that existed at their primary school, socioeconomically, cultural diversity that did not, and this is, again, as to also indicate this was 20 years ago, 15 years ago for, well, third grade, not quite that long. But it was many years ago. But it really, we chose to stay at our neighborhood school. That was a primary reason. We felt that our kids could, perhaps being bright, could help other children at the school and also continue to flourish and to become the people we hoped for them to be by remaining in a diverse and challenging school. And they did. I would ask staff, I think, to help everyone understand what opportunities exist at all our other sites for accelerated learning and what we are doing, because we are doing wonderful things, and Teach is, as a program, serves children, but I'm not convinced. I know that were Mr. Crabb at any other school, he would be providing the same level of challenge and educational opportunities no matter what the makeup of what his classroom looked like. I think that we have gifted and talented teachers in this district. And but I would like to be able to reassure all parents in all schools of the opportunities that are available to all kids. I spent a little time earlier today. I had to take my mother to the eye doctor, and the eye doctor and I ended up spending about 20 minutes talking about the Teach program, because her eye doctor is Glenn Olker, who is a former trustee. And Glenn struggled with his own children, with where to send them to school, and he chose to keep them at the neighborhood school. And again, this is anecdotal. His son, who he was the most concerned with whether or not to send him to Teach, is now a PhD candidate at MIT after being a proud graduate of C.L. Smith Elementary School. I think that we owe it to all of our children to teach all of them to the highest possible level, and I think that our district is capable of doing that. We're capable of improving that. We're striving to improve that through our initiatives and through the new hires and through our professional development. And but I do want to be able to solidly assure all parents of what we're doing at all of our schools in that regard. Thank you.
Catherine.
I would like to address what I think we've already been told about what we're doing in all of our schools, and I think what we'll hear back is that we're doing what is known as differentiated learning. And I'd also like to comment on Dr. Mary Bacon's reaction to that statement. Dr. Mary Bacon is an expert in cultural competency, who came and offered in our county for any school board members or teachers who were interested in attending that all-day conference. An incredible insight into getting into the heads of the different kinds of children, how many different children populate our classrooms, and how to meet them each where they come from which they come. And so she had dealt with all the various, you know, expected groups that we thought we would be there to talk about, the at-need, at-risk kids. And then she started talking about gifted and talented students as well. And she asked the group of educators who were there, what are you doing for your gifted and talented? What are you doing for your GATE kids? Do you have a GATE program here? And everyone looked at each other in this room, and everyone said, finally, well, we're doing differentiated learning for our accelerated students. And her response to that was, I see, so you're doing nothing. That really caught my interest, so I took the opportunity to come to her during the lunch break to say, tell me more about why you said that, because that is something we are struggling with in our district right now. And it's, you know, not, I wasn't just thinking of Teach, I was thinking of every school that we have where we have accelerated learners, and what are we doing for those accelerated learners. And her point was twofold. One is that it's impossible. I mean, what most people have already mentioned here tonight, what tends to happen when you try to differentiate and you have that group of children to help is you're going to gravitate toward the ones who need you most. And we need to bring those kids along. And we all agree that that's our mission as a board and a district. We have to help those children. And so what do we do unconsciously, perhaps, as teachers? We say to the children who are already getting it, help the kid next to you, or work ahead in your book. And what happens to those students, as you've identified, is they get bored, they get disruptive, they get difficult, and they just check out. And there's umpteen research to support that by this time those kids get to high school, these are the kids who are using drugs to make it more interesting. They're not attending school because it's boring, and we have a responsibility to try to fix that problem. Teach isn't the be-all, end-all for fixing that problem, but it does service a particular group of students who might otherwise be causing those problems and having those difficulties. So I wanted to speak to Dr. Mary Bacon. And I just wanted to comment, Walter, on one of the comments you made about the corrosive environment. I do have to acknowledge that when my oldest son first attended Teach, it was right after it had moved onto the Bishop's Peak campus. And that word would probably have applied during that first and second and third year that the school was downsized into three portables. But I have got to give huge props to Dan Block, because when he came on as principal of those two schools, he has built a team and a collegial relationship between the teaching staffs and the students in the entire school. It has changed exponentially just in the amount of time that I was there as a parent over, I guess that was a 10-year period of time. So I just needed to comment on that observation you made.
Thank you for your comment. I still stand by my statement. Mr. Questenberry.
Well, first of all, I want to commend the Teach parents on being here and being articulate and eloquent in your defense of the school. I also had children that went through this district. Both my daughters graduated from here. Both have gone on to their post-secondary educations. My experience is more than 20 years ago, and I found that the neighborhood schools, I consciously made a choice at that time because my older daughter was identified as, you know, gifted and talented, although I think my younger daughter is equally gifted and talented, just in a different way, and I found that by putting our efforts there and looking at the teachers there, that my daughters received an excellent education and were challenged. And I can report that my older daughter, the Teach candidate, has a master's degree and has been extremely successful going through the neighborhood school, going to the local middle school and on to the local high school. I realize that there are students that need to be challenged. My daughter was challenged, and she did participate in the GATE program. So, yes, I think what we'd like to do is take those kinds of teachers, those kinds of programs, and make them available to all our students at all our sites. And, you know, my experience is that the teachers at almost all of our sites, I can't speak for every one of them, but are excellent teachers, and they are concerned with challenging kids and making learning fun and interesting. And so I don't want to be less than honest with the people here, is that I have kind of a particular bias, and they should know that. But I do appreciate everything that has been said. I have to go back and maybe do some hard thinking on this before I come to any decision. But I believe that your children could get as good an education at any one of our elementary sites in this district.
Okay, well, I guess staff has gotten a couple of things. I'm not sure I agree that I want staff time spent on researching GATE programs. We've already been down that road, and it didn't work out very well. I would like to suggest the board that we instruct staff to have the principal and teachers at Bishop's Peak Teach work out a preliminary plan on how they would merge the two schools, either under item 5 or item 6, because to some extent they're related, with the emphasis on determining what specific things are being done at Teach that are not being done at Bishop's Peak and other classrooms in the district, and to bring back a report to the board that would give us some outlines of how it would look if we were to either absorb Teach into Bishop's Peak or do 5, phase out the Teach school program.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Hi. I want to say that I think that what we're both asking is for staff time. And I've asked staff time to answer some of my questions.
Sure.
You've just asked them to do a lot of work on your behalf.
Well, no.
Excuse me.
What I asked was I put an idea out there for the board to consider to provide consensus and give direction to staff. That's what
I appreciate.
Go
that.
Ahead.
And I just want you to know, I think that all of us have made input tonight. I think all of us have thought this through to some extent, and I believe that my questions are as valuable as yours.
Nobody suggested your questions were any less valuable than mine. Really? Really, folks? At any rate, do I have any support on the board for my direction to staff?
I would support that. However, I would not support it as a notion of taking action. I would support it as something I would be interested in knowing more about how that could look, but not with the predetermination of action on either number 5 or number 6. And the truth is, I'm interested in if we're talking about what are we offering accelerated learners in our district. Because my understanding is we really don't have what used to be the GATE program anymore. When we got the Tier 3 flexibility, we chose to put that money into the general fund. So we don't have specific targets for accelerated learners. What are we doing for I'm curious, what are we doing for accelerated learners besides what we call differentiated learning? And I think that is an important question. I think the sense it does disturb me to hear a lot of conversation about how Teach is the only school that offers this kind of opportunity or experience for students in our district. I know that the initiatives are working toward that. I know when we talk about the STEAM program, our hope is that the STEAM program at Los Osos Middle School will help that in our 6, 7, 8. it seems to me we either have a broken system or we have the perception of a broken system. And that's part of going to have to be part of the conversation for me as well. So I hope in terms of gathering information, Walter, I'll support that. But in terms of making a decision, it's just more information for me to have right now because I'm not prepared to make a decision tonight.
I was not making a decision. I was trying to provide some direction to staff as far as getting some information.
So I would support that. Yeah. But I do think that we need to look at redistricting. And no matter what else, I think we should be looking at that anyway. And again, as I mentioned before, that would be something that I think the staff should just consider whether we need another demographic study or whether we need to update the demographic study that we had 5 or 6 years ago. I don't know. And have things changed so much that that's something we would need.
Go ahead.
Dare I step in?
Yeah.
If I could for a moment, I wrote down everything I could from what I heard, and this is a pretty significant list to investigate, dig into, and I'm certainly prepared to do that. I have to bite my lip because I do have responses, but it's not appropriate until I vet it, you know, and authenticate it. The last thing I want to do, because I unfortunately the word differentiation has been abused. And I was at Dr. Mary Bacon's workshop as well, and we invited her here, and the whole San Luis Obispo High School staff and Pack Beach staff came. She's fabulous and wonderful. And I did ask her about some of the other things that we have going on, and she spoke to that as well. So what I will do is if I hear this, is I'm from Mark, I heard from Mr. Buckman, I heard traffic concerns and concerns specifically around safety, egress, ingress, egress for emergency issues. So what could we do to look at that? I'd be interested in knowing what the county's and perhaps the state gate model looks like, knowing for sure the state has gutted that program a long time ago. I have a strong response about what we're working on to not put lip service to differentiate instruction. But actually, if you just walk through the schools, you'll see ability groupings, you'll see skill level groupings, you'll see clusters of students working together or working on specific tasks that are aligned to their ability levels within the context of a same classroom. A deeper understanding of comprehensive literacy will give you that. Different schools are doing it differently, but I think I've seen some great progress towards that. Dr. Catherine Eisenrath-Rogers said that she'd like to know what's involved in adding portables. Can we use developer fees on the existing campus? Traffic issues, what's the feasibility of coming up with some innovative solutions? So I would have to look at that, and that's a possibility. Wanting to know information about when the Bishop's Peak boundary changes were made, and can we revisit that? How many parents were using open enrollment to enter Bishop's Peak with plans to send their kids to teach ultimately and to gain the data on that? That won't be hard to do. How are we accelerating students in San Luis Coastal? What's our plan? It's a great question. And I can work on giving you that at where we are now and then where we're going. Dr. Mary Bacon was the conversation about the differentiated instruction equals doing nothing. I would have a strong opinion about that, as I think it's part of her presence and her presentation, but I can give you 20 teachers just off the top of my head in this district in the 4th through 6th grade level that do it every day and do it well with integrity. So I can speak to that. Mr. Quisenberry spoke about the idea of what is the true cost impact if we were to move Teach to a different site, specifically Sunnyside or Morro L, or you know, what does that look like? He appreciated the T teach, as I did, Bishop's Peak and teach parents and how they've articulated their concerns. It's helped me. And he shared some personal experiences with his own kids, specifically about neighborhood schools and the value of that. Mr. Unger talked about looking at redistricting the boundaries, what would be involved with that. It's worthwhile. Bishop's Peak is it's surrounded by two open enrollment schools. So that community is pretty big, and I think that's worthwhile looking at. Looking at demographics, the study in our district was worthwhile, and the acknowledgement that we can't continue to grow teach on the Bishop's Peak campus is the statement that was made. Mr. Unger Mr. Millar spoke, rejected the notion that acceleration is unique only to teach, and that having two schools on one campus can be corrosive, and that whatever we do, we should, and this is the words of a parent there, whatever we do, we should maintain what is going on. The magic at Teach should continue at all of our schools. Our strategic initiatives are driving this district, and it's a priority, and we should focus on that because it could bring us home. Can't favor moving Teach to another site, and he personally favors options 5 and 6 and would seek feedback from the board to pursue a project or a report from Mr. Block and perhaps the Bishop's Peak and Teach staff to identify what that might look like if they were to merge or if they were to phase out, and just give an executive summary of what that could look like. Mrs. Sheffer spoke about her experiences with neighborhood schools and her own children, and diversity and challenging can coexist. I'm having to work hard at this. This is good. And what opportunities exist in our district for acceleration? What specifically is out there? Because parents deserve a strong reassurance or an assurance that that we have their interests in mind as well. And those things, if I were to consolidate and pull it all together, would be one long meeting in my office. And I'm prepared to do it. It's very important. And then come back to you at the next board meeting with the best that I can to pull that together, or at least put together some elements of it. And then that could serve as discussion.
I only just want to make one correction. Apparently I was inelegant in my expression. I don't favor 5 and 6. I don't know what I favor. Oh. I know I disfavor 1 through 4. That's why I wanted more information.
Got it. I see. Okay.
Anybody else want to correct Dr. Prater?
I don't want to correct Dr. Prater, but I noticed my name was conspicuously absent from the list of instructions Dr. Prater had received. And it's largely because I just need to think about this. It's come hard and fast, and now we're being asked to make a decision in a very short time frame. I have not historically been a proponent of Teach. I also had a gifted and talented student, in fact, who tested the highest of anyone tested in the district as a third grader the year he was tested. And I elected to keep him in my community school, and that has served us well. But that having been my personal experience, I need to dignify the feelings of others who are whose children are benefiting from the Teach experience. So there's just a lot for me to think about in this whole thing. I think differentiation, regardless of what Dr. Bacon says, is the only way we're going to achieve accelerated instruction, because the GATE program really was always a joke. It never had any funding behind it, and it was not fully funded. So there was nothing that teachers could do. They had nominal monies. It was an after-school program. And just because you're a bright student doesn't necessarily mean you want to stay at school longer.
Are you kidding? We just got the action.
maybe what you want is for things that are challenging to happen during your regular school day. So, hence the importance of differentiated instruction. So, just because I didn't speak previously doesn't mean I haven't been present for the discussion, and I am thinking very hard on this subject. So, thank you.
Thank you, Marilyn. No one would accuse Marilyn of not letting us know her view on things, for sure. Okay, any further discussion by the board? Okay, thank you all, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to move on. We're going to take a quick break based on the weaklings in the crowd. So we'll be back in five.
Oh, okay. I got you. All right. Consider it. Thank you, Mr. Miller.
I'm helping.
I'm glad I didn't send you home early.
I only want to get out of here.
Board members, please take your seats. Did Marilyn get back in?
Yes, she did.
Kim?
Mr. Pinkerton, will you please quit disrupting the meeting and have your seat, please? Thank you.
She's here. She's in. Here she comes. Okay, we'll be moving on to the action consent agenda.
Take a little Ambien and head off to bed.
You got it. Okay, we're going to pull item 9.08 for Dr. Delkiskamp to make a couple of corrections. Not yet, though, Rita. We have to go through the other ones first. Okay, everybody ready?
Close the door here somewhere.
If we do it right, maybe. Okay, this will be action consent items. Let me know which ones you want pulled. And again, we've already pulled 9.08. 9.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 9.02, disposition of surplus property. 9.03, acceptance of donations. 9.04, approval of equipment requests. Mrs. Roger would like that one pulled. Approval of 9.05, approval of purchase orders. 9.06, approval of warrants and payroll. 9.07, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, Williams settlement. And item 9.09, price increase for breakfast lunch for elementary and secondary.
And can I ask you to please pull that?
Pull that one, okay.
Thank you.
So we have available for a motion 9.01 through 03, 05, 06, and 08. And I'll make that motion.
So, I'll second it.
Because I don't think anybody else could remember the numbers. Okay. Well, all in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Passes 7-0. And Kim, you have the specific numbers that were approved. Okay, thank you. I'm glad you are able to do that. So we will move to 9.04, Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. Under the furniture and equipment requests, I just wanted a little explanation of a $55,000 rotary mower, given our economic circumstances.
What we have a situation where the district has two lawnmowers that mow 100 acres of turf, and we have a very large mower. We'll call it the gang mower because it has a bunch of lawn mowing blades underneath its platform. And then we have a smaller lawn mower that you would typically see around the district office in small spaces that is 48 inches on its deck. So the large gang mower is very old, and it has been held together seriously with baling wire and duct tape for a couple of years. And the mechanics are actually keeping it alive, but it's in imminent danger of collapse. So what we've done is we've issued a purchase order. We haven't issued it pending your approval, but we have a purchase order to buy a replacement lawnmower. We initially were looking for something smaller, quicker, more maneuverable, but we found many limitations in the ability to mow to the depth we wish, to perform at the speed we need. It's an efficiency issue on size versus cost versus personnel to man the lawnmowers to do 100 acres.
Okay, I'm not an expert on lawnmowers. I think I once bought a Craftsman. But I'm assuming that we made some, that we did a sort of an exhaustive study of lawnmowers and their various, and the price range, and that and this is really what we need and this is what it costs. I don't begrudge that, but I just wanted some explanation because it...
We didn't go out and buy the Craftsman. We actually went out and did a very... Arnie was in charge of... Arnie Salacci, our supervisor of grounds grounds, actually, did a... He took so long, I was getting irritated with him because he was so careful. He was inviting people out for visits. He was...
Did he have a mobile lawn?
He had the mobile lawns. But that turned out to be the benefit of not buying that initial lawnmower, is because once he saw it in operation, he realized we can't use that in our needs. So the answer is yes. We looked at all kinds of different sizes, models, and manufacturers. We settled on the first one, asked them to come out and perform. It didn't perform like we wanted, so we went on to the next one and realized that we really were in the market for a very large lawnmower that went at a pretty good clip that could get this done in a
clip.
That was pretty good. I wish it was intentional. But so, yes, the answer is we did look at it very carefully.
Okay. Well, thank you. I just wanted a little explanation, and I appreciate it.
Mr. Miller is often funny in advertising.
Oh, and so I will... what is this item number?
9.04.
I'll move approval of item 9.4.
I'll second it.
Okay, thank you. And I'd also point out, for those who may be interested, that lawn mowing is more than just aesthetics and appearance. It has to do with safety on playing fields, et cetera. So, any further discussion by board members? Okay, seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. And let's see, Dr. Delkiskamp, did you want to do 9.08, please?
Thank you. I wanted to make one correction to this item before the board takes action on it. In coming up with these committees, and we've had career technical education advisory committees in our district, we just haven't been asked before to bring them to the board for approval. So in preparing this item, what we did is we have quite a robust advisory committee, and the members on here are who served that purpose last March. We did update it and remove teachers who were no longer in our district but made the mistake of leaving a student on the list who is no longer in our district, and that's Johnny Hammerlin. So I'd like to seek approval of this committee with that correction to remove the student, and also letting you know that we are in the process of trying to attract more students to serve on this committee with us.
I'll make a motion to approve 9.08 with the correction as Dr. Dalkus-Cramp described.
We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Ms. Shepherd. Any further discussion?
I'd just like to add, as the ROP rep and the work that Rita's done in the community advisory committee, it is part of the requirement for an ROP program to have, and it's like that's where it starts, is with the community businesses telling us what they're looking for in graduates, and it's spelled out in Ed Code. So I'd really like to thank you very much for working so hard on that.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. Further, all in favor? Aye. Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. And we think that's... Oh, Mark, did you want 9.09?
Yeah, just really quickly. When I saw this increase, I was thinking about all the parents and all the people that are having economic problems with the economy right now, and was a little concerned about raising the cost of... the lunch program, and did talk to Mr. Miller about it. And I think one of the important things that I learned was that it's a federal reimbursement program, and there is some benefit to the district for having people participate that are qualified, and that we need to continue to seek out in a sort of a little more robust way. Families that that do qualify. There's a story of a gentleman who did not know about the program. He's been unemployed for 2 years and didn't even know that he qualified for the program and the students. And we all know that hungry kids just are not going to learn as well. So I would move to approve this.
9.09. Okay. I'll second. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 7-0. And we will move on to advanced agenda. Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I would like to ask that we direct the staff to create and present a study session on school safety. And I'd like support for that.
Yeah, I will definitely support that.
I will support it as well.
That's a great idea. I will put that together and coordinate dates. We did initially discuss the idea of a budget study session next Tuesday, probably not with you, but with our team.
Yes. Yeah.
And so on our calendars,
we're guilty too.
We have that time frame that could be a. It's just a quick turnaround. So perhaps I could propose, I'm gone the last few days of January, so maybe in February we could find a date. Maybe Kim could make those arrangements to coordinate the dates in February for a study session on school safety.
But we are still good to go on the 22nd.
Oh. No, so that, right, that's it's premature now that we don't know exactly where the SF squared is landing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'd like to know a little bit more about what that means, what a study session on school security means. So,
I would like to see what. I think it's an important topic. I think we all know it's an important topic, and you're right, Walter. We need to narrow it down. What is it that we particularly want to talk about? I think I have an interest in what are we doing right now so that the board and the community can be aware of the safety measures we're taking, and then what kinds of things could we be doing? I think that's important. And if we need to fund it, where could the funding come from? I mean, there are some issues out there and some questions that I think we're going to need to answer.
And I've been doing some work with the county superintendent of schools. Our last week's superintendent council meeting, we met along with Sheriff Ian Parkinson, San Luis Obispo Chief, Police Chief Steve Gassell, and Chief Haley from Atascadero. And they all met with us to talk about next steps, and the agreement among the superintendents, at least, was that we were concerned that one district would do one extreme measure to respond to the current crises, while another district may not, and people would be confused. Sheriff Parkinson suggested a similar standard operating templates and maps for campuses that are united in an electronic document, so the responders could at least have an awareness of plants and the basic outline of the map of each campus in their jurisdiction. So that was mentioned, and so Dr. Crocker and Sheriff Parkinson are collaborating on that, and I know that the police chief in San Luis has expressed interest in meeting with me to discuss our schools in San Luis Obispo that he oversees or helps assist and support. So I'm having a lot of people come to me and talk to me. My belief that a coordinated sort of agreed upon approach to these are the steps we should take in terms of communicating our plans, communicating to the public this is what we do. But I would seek that direction in such a study session. I could bring to you what we have. We could talk about it, and at that point you could provide a little more clarity as to what your expectations would be.
It's a good point.
All right. I do have some concerns that we are circumspect in the specifics that we discuss in a public forum, though. But we can work that out. And
Mr. Mayor?
Jim and I will do it. Yeah, Ellen?
I would just add that I'm concerned about that I support this, but I think we're really busy for the next couple of months, and to see if we've got the budget, we've got the March notifications of two employees of potential layoffs that I would not have a problem, in fact, with waiting until after maybe mid-March to have this study session so that everyone has time to do everything that's already on their plates and give the attention it deserves. Would that be acceptable to you?
No, I think I'd like to hear from the administration what's going to work for them. I feel some urgency to talk about this. I think it's important for us, again, just to talk, to hear amongst ourselves, working with Mr. Quisenberry and Mr. Millar on what are the specific topics. But I think it's important that we let our community know what kinds of things we're doing in the schools and if there are policy implications. And there may be policy implications. There may be things that we want to do. And some of them may be political. We may, for example, want to support legislation to limit high-velocity assault weapons. I mean, there are some things that we need to wrestle with. And so, you know, I would just leave it to Dr. Prater and Mr. Robinette working with these guys to come up with a date that's workable. But I do feel some sense of urgency for this.
Okay. All right, Marilyn?
Well, we have crisis response protocols in place, and they're uniform throughout the district. So could you just bring those to the study session? Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good. And reports by board members. Mark.
Thank you very much.
I had the opportunity to go out to Los Osos Middle School to judge History Day, and I arrived too late, so I unfortunately wasn't able to be a judge. However, it was an absolutely amazing event. I'd like to thank the teachers out there, Gail Goodman, Blair Brinkman, Amy Harris, Greg Wilcox, and Vicki Rayburn, for doing such a great job with the kids. What was interesting is when I was out there, there were the groundspeople were pulling up plants and getting ready to plant native plants all around the school. And then I stopped in to say hi to Dr. Pruitt, and sure enough, there was Jeff Guy and a bunch of maintenance and buildings and grounds guys getting ready to start working on the school. And there's a lot going on out there. It was really, really a good visit.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, I got an opportunity to go to Del Mar for lunch, which was real nice. I got to see my wife and talk to some of the teachers there. As part of my job, I do observations of teachers, and one of my specialists was at Baywood teaching a visually impaired student. And it was really exciting to see the work that this teacher was doing to help the student navigate the campus using a cane and almost echolocution. And then to be able to talk to the teachers about things that are there, that are going on at Baywood. But the way this particular child was integrated into the school was really, really nice to see. It was a great experience. And then I did get to judge at History Day. And one of the coolest things that I saw was the description of how Rosa Parks changed history, and the way that was presented by the students, and the group of students. It was four students, two guys and two girls, and it's the way the country looks. It's great. It was a really wonderful experience.
Thank you. Ellen?
I don't usually give these reports, but I will state that I attended the workshop on homelessness on Saturday, and felt that it was very interesting, and I think that our community still tends to see our homeless population we paint them with a broad brush, and many people still see our homeless population as not including children and families, as being primarily people who sleep on a park bench and pee in public. And it was important, I felt, to bring out and to discuss and hopefully raise an awareness level of the families and children in our community who are homeless. So it was worthwhile to attend. I have no idea where the community will land on this, on the location, on the services to provide, but it was interesting to see that about 150 people came out for that, and there is recognition that the problem exists and needs to be addressed. So that's my report.
Mr. Millar, if I can.
Please.
I'd like to take an unabashed opportunity to announce an event that's coming up, and there will be a free event at 6 p.m. at Laguna on January 31st. CAPSLO, YMCA, PTA, 4-H, Asset Development Network are bringing in a speaker to talk about understanding your child's interactions both on and offline, and I would really urge everybody to go to that. Thank you.
Okay. I would just like to tell the viewing public and those in the audience that mock trial begins January 26th, which is a Saturday, at 9:30 at the courthouse in San Luis Obispo. And SLO High School and Pacific Beach High School will be competing in the morning, and then in the afternoon, I think it starts at 1, those schools will be competing reverse with the competition from the morning. And then the next day, the next competition, I believe, is January 29th at the courthouse and starts at 5:30. That's the 26th is a Saturday, and the 29th is a Tuesday. And it's an amazing competition to watch. Get there early. It's always cozy in the courtroom. And we're excited about PV's chances. But, of course, we're pulling for the Tigers, too. Anyway, anybody else have anything for the good of the cause? Thank you all. We'll be in adjourned. Thank you.